he's a living legend in our neighborhood. He helped me understand my story.
The whole idea is he's never leaving you.
Every story has a hero and a bad guy. Sometimes it's the little things that decide what we're gonna be. This is my story. My name is Tubi. These are my friends, my crew. Playing ball was our thing. It was where heroes got to practice for battle. This is Mighty. Ever since the third grade, Mighty knew it all, at least when it came to school. Mighty was one of those guys you needed to be friends with in order to get through school. This is Willie. Willie was all about the beats. For better or worse, his head was always in the music. Sometimes he even forgot to change his clothes. Good stories have a princess, too. Virtue's the princess in this story. She's also one of the heroes. Yeah, missed that one bad. Didn't feel much like a hero right then. And yeah, she was right there for the whole thing.
This is what you meant to do.
This is Rand. He was the man. There were so many times when I wanted to be him. When he led his team to the state championship. And like, right now.
Yo, T, isn't that your girl over there?
Nah.
Well, talk to him, man.
You know what? That's cool.
This is our neighborhood. These are my friends. This is where my story starts.
Good.
Yeah, you can go ahead and see if you can get that PowerPoint out. So that's environmental education for the North Bay Adventure Center. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about this place. It's a pretty novel approach. They also are a place with a lot of resources, which enables them to do things that other programs can't do. They were started out by John Erickson, who was the person behind Erickson Retirement Homes. So they had a lot of money to give them. And the idea was, can they build some place where they could bring every sixth grader, I'm supposed to speak into this, right? Every sixth grader out of Baltimore City out to this place, and provide a mountaintop experience, or what we might call a movie, they can bring back and eventually change the culture of Baltimore City schools. So they also do local rural schools as well as other schools throughout Maryland. So what North Bay does, here's their mission, all right? I'll just highlight a couple things about this. Challenge middle school students to realize that their attitudes and actions can have a lasting impact on the future of the environment and the people around them. So it's not quite a traditional environmental education statement, but you know, every nature center's got, we connect people with nature. This is much more specific, right? This is, no, we want them to recognize that what they do impacts this stuff in themselves. Okay, so it's a slightly different definition than what we typically see. Just to take you through, they have a motto. This is a place that's in near Northeast Maryland. It's on the Chesapeake Bay. They have a large campus. They have a gym. Two climbing walls, they're right next to a state park, they can go hiking. They have a number of pretty big campus with lodges, nice eating facilities, etc. They also have a high ropes course, all the students do. They have a zip line that goes from about a 70-foot tower that's up on a hill to begin with, and the zip line goes all the way down into the water in Chesapeake Bay. Most of the students do that while they're there. So there is an adventure component. They base their entire system on the IEIA model. So that's investigating and evaluating environmental issues and actions. So they get students out to places around their facility there, and they ask questions. They use inquiry-based stuff. So they're out looking at mussels and the roles mussels play. Primarily, though, what they're trying to do through this model is to get kids to think about their role in these problems and their solutions. So as they once they get to a point where they've got something that's if they get the science down, they get a whole bunch of newspaper clippings. And they get all these different perspectives on, well, what's happening to the Bay? What do farmers say? Industry say? What do the feds say, right? And they start to talk about what are the potential solutions to those problems. They do it in a pretty darn culturally relevant way. So during the day, they'll take them out to a wetland, let's say, and talk about how wetlands are filters for the environment. In the evening, they'll come into a multimedia theater and they'll watch that movie. And there's another movie, I think there might be three, and they intersperse them over the course of the week. So each night they're watching pieces of the movie that relate to what they learned that day. So when they talk about wetlands as filters, at night, you can see it's a pretty high quality movie. It's about who are the filters in your life? Do you have role models? So they relate it to role models. The next day is about invasive species. That talks about what they call future killers, teen pregnancy, alcoholism, crime, drugs. The third day is about biological diversity, and they relate that to cultural diversity and how that can be a strength in the community. The last day, this is a picture from the last day in the first year of this program, they talk about ecological niche, or niche, and how they like to pronounce it. Is there a right pronunciation?
There are two right pronunciations.
What's that?
There are two correct pronunciations.
Oh, great. I got a problem with it. Okay. And they relate that to students choosing their own identity. You're in charge of who you are. No matter what comes flying at you, you get to decide the role you play in your community. So they send kids sort of what they did here, and they've changed this practice since, but this is Corey. He's the lead disciplinarian. He's holding a brick. It's like, come touch the rock, make a commitment. You're going to choose who you're going to be. And I've been there for this, and kids are crying and hugging their teachers. It's pretty powerful stuff. So they do this. There's some live action stuff. Kids get involved in it as well. They really mingle the positive youth development literature with environmental education. So those of you familiar with that, this is general after-school programming stuff. This is keep kids out of trouble by keeping them busy and giving them an identity or strengthening whatever their identity already is and character development kind of stuff. So I'm going to just take you really briefly through the evaluation results in about a minute and a half if I can, and then I will just contrast this to another program in the same exact population. So we did pre, post, and follow-up surveys. So when students get there, they get off a bus, they take a survey. And then right before they leave, they take a survey, and then 3 months later, they take a survey. And so here's how they were measuring environmental responsibility, and you can see the intermingling of positive youth development here. Recognition that they can do things that matter, but a lot of this has to do with their community. So the definition of environment here is not nature and National Geographics or national parks, it's where they go home to. And all of the education is about that. How does this relate back to you at home? Character development and leadership. So this isn't your typical sort of church character development leadership or religious spiritual stuff about being a good neighbor and all that stuff. It's basically, I'm in charge of what I do and I can build a network of people around me to help me. That's their idea of character development and leadership. They take initiative to do things. Attitudes towards school. This is a little more straightforward, but not quite. I enjoy school. I'm interested in learning about these things, going to college. I have teachers that really care about me. I have teachers that truly believe that I will succeed. It's about their school environment, too, and how they view it. And North Bay has this goal that over time they will actually maybe start to change the home school environment as every student cycles through here over time. Okay, so I'm going to make the results really fast. I've been evaluating this program for 6 years now. The first couple of years, those first two indexes, this one and this one, great, off the charts, super, they were rock stars. This one was harder to hit. In year five, they were hitting it short term every year. They finally got that long term 3 month follow up in year five with this. And they started a follow on program in year five where they would go to the schools and help action projects. So it made a difference. So they're showing long term gain. There are some really interesting things we found. We expected when we went in there, you know, they do the urban kids from inner city Baltimore, and then they've got rural kids, primarily from the county around them, but they've expanded since. On pre-experience scores, on those indexes I showed you, urban students were higher before they even came in than rural students, and higher when they came out. So some of the assumptions we were making, we expected, it's going to be, I don't know where they're going to be. We're going to have to work extra hard. They were higher on all of those index coming in. So there's a lot to be said for the assumptions we make about students before they come in. And I have a paper here. We can put this on your website, too. Actually, you can email me if you want a copy of it. And there's copies here. I don't have that copyright stuff. That talks about that, why we think that is. We also had some interesting stuff. We had questions on there asking students whether they felt like they had a role model and who that role model was before, immediately after, and follow up. So students who gained a role model over the course of this exhibited more positive impacts in the program. And so this program was set up for that. They had a lot of teachers coming from the same neighborhoods these students were from. Right? It's a big mix. They've got a very diverse staff there. And different students would gravitate towards different folks. So those who gained an adult role model actually is going to be more popular than those. So in short, this is a super successful program. I'm going to contrast that to a program that takes place in inner city Baltimore. It doesn't take place anymore, but I'm not going to identify who they are. School programs, grades K to 8, Urban Park, they do what I call project type stuff. Like it wasn't Project Learning Tree or Project Letter, Project File, but the same type of thing. Really cool one-off activities. Students would come in for 2 to 4 times over the course of the year, and they'd spend 2 to 2.5 hours in this Urban Park with an instructor and their teacher, and they would do, honestly, cool. We'd all look at it and be like, oh man, your curriculum looks great. Nothing in terms of positive results. It was okay for kids K to 3. We had a very simplistic measure there, like, yeah, I liked it, and I like the environment now. For the same age group we're talking about, 5th and 6th grade, nothing. So why? What was going on here? Well, there are a few things. One, they did not have a very good discipline program for these kids when they came in. And all of us, everyone who's been in the classroom knows, unless you have the classroom management piece down, the rest is completely lost no matter what you do. And I think that's something that we don't think about a lot as researchers of environmental ed, but that came out very clearly here. There's the dosage issue again, the duration. These are individual, one-off little things that happen. And there was no attempt to make it explicitly culturally relevant. Right? It happened to be in an urban park in these kids' neighborhood, but the content wasn't adapted for what these kids were doing at home or facing. Whereas at North Bay, they even put, after the first year, they put counselors in the cabins at night to debrief the day. Kids would cry and have emotional experiences. So I have two extremes of the spectrum, but most of us wouldn't consider this an extreme at all. This is a model, like, this is what we do, right? I'd argue this can work too, but again, it comes down to all these best practices that we're talking about. So these were the outcomes that we measured. No, it's just me, that I measured in that one. So you can see it's kind of the same stuff we were looking at in North Bay. This was a big index that all hung together. I couldn't get it to separate out. So you can get to see it's a lot of the same thing. So it's close to the same outcomes. All right, so what lessons did we learn? Here's that tower at North Bay. And the zip line comes out of here. And they also have a boat. And they do cool stuff. I would say for different audiences, we have to think about how we define environment. Right? It is very different for a rural kid from a rural county than it is for a kid in Baltimore City. We need to think about which environment do we even care about when we're thinking about outcomes. Maybe very different. The idea of intermingling empowerment, specific empowerment with character development, leadership skills in the environmental ed seems to really strengthen this particular program. Provide a new role model, so that's kind of in line with some of the stuff we talked earlier as well. They've got a really unique setting here, and it's not like this is going to be very easy to duplicate, but it's a culturally appropriate yet novel setting. So they're taking kids out here, and I've heard kids say, oh my god, a deer's going to eat me! And they come here, but they have like cool cabins, they have a game room, they can play basketball in their free time. Like, there is stuff that makes you feel comfortable out here, even if you're, you know, never been to a place like this before. So it's a little different than, you know, taking up old rag on their very first time ever out in Washington, D.C. It's also, this is my point of the day, I guess, a holistic experience. I mean, they're really trying to make this a beginning to end experience, taking each piece and connecting it to something that's meaningful and relevant to kids' everyday lives, and building in that reflection each night when they go back to their cabins. They're reflecting on what they learned that day and how it affects them at home. And we started to talk about this issue of control a little bit. I don't know how many folks have seen David Sobel's recent article in Orion, where he's talking about the Nature Center educator who's not letting kids touch anything. They have a pretty good approach here. They specifically call it organized chaos. And there's a certain amount of freedom that they allow kids. And when it gets to a certain point, their disciplinary approach is that whoever, you know, is in trouble ends up in the disciplinarian's office until they accept responsibility for what they did and kind of own up to it. They sit there. And if in 24 hours they don't, they get sent home. So they've had kids sitting in that office overnight. So I just wanted to, we thought it would be kind of neat to just case study this real briefly and think, yes, this is sort of as far as you can go on one spectrum, but I think there's pieces of this that can be built into simpler programs like the one I evaluated that didn't show any positive results.
Any questions at all for
working with that?
I have a question. Certainly the cultural relevance resonates strongly, and what you presented, and I'm sure there's more to it than what you've been able to present, but certainly seems very urban, youth-focused. So at first blush, it doesn't surprise me at all that that didn't resonate as much with rural students. They're rural students from my part of Maryland go to this program, and certainly some of those issues do, and some of them do in a broad sense, but maybe not in the specific way it's presented, or people look different than they're used to looking. So I wonder how much you thought about that.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because the differences, the change differences, they were there in year one, they disappeared. So the rural students, this is impacting them just as much. And our thinking on it is that, you know, this urban culture is so pervasive in pop culture that, you know, rural kids from Cecil County get it when they see that Baltimore City movie. Now, in year between years 2 and 3, they started adding rural components to the videos. And what's been really interesting, we haven't been able to study it yet, but I have a doctoral student starting who's going to be looking at this stuff, is how that cross-pollinates. Like, if the urban kids watch the, like, rural kids on tractors doing their thing, and vice versa, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
Well, I think that's a misconception right there, because the rural kids aren't on tractors. They're probably not in the woods a whole lot more than the urban kids. It's just their culture. I mean, the culture is different. For one thing, it's very white, as an example. So they're not, typically we have the opposite problem, but in this case, these kids aren't seeing kids on the screen, dealing with maybe some of the same issues, but don't necessarily look like them, or issues that are similar, but from a different angle. But those kids might be just as common to say, you know, some of them, their parents are hunting, but others of them, many, many of them are, oh yeah, the deer might eat me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good point. And another thing we were thinking about was with the rural kids is it's sort of, it may be just as irrelevant, the nature that's out there. So using the term community and home community makes a lot more sense, right? But this started as something that was focused on these inner city kids, and they actually took the Cecil County kids in just because they were their neighbors. Right? They didn't design it for that. So they're shifting their design toward that. But I think it is fascinating that it seems to have impacted those Cecil County kids and other kids in a positive way as well, even though the content wasn't geared towards them.
Right.
But we're going to be looking into it, and I can't wait, because I really don't know what the answer is. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Mark.
So that's going to lead us into, I'm glad Mark talked about a program that does use IEIA, because that's kind of where we're going now. We're going to be looking at this afternoon some more specific models, and specifically some of the you know, what characteristics of those models can lead us to different outcomes, and this one, we're just going to talk with Trudy, and then we're going to be talking a little bit about the behavioral outcomes with this, but certainly there's other outcomes we're interested in. Dr. Trudy Volk, is the executive director, as she already mentioned, of the Center for Instruction, Staff Development, and Evaluation in Carbondale, where she's also a professor, emeritus professor at Southern Illinois University. She brings decades of experience in environmental ed, both program development and research, here with her today. As I already mentioned, she was one of the developers of the IEIA model. And I think most people in here are familiar with that, but in case you aren't, what that does is it focuses on students analyzing and investigating environmental issues in their own communities and around the world. I know IEEIA is used all over. It's used at North Bay. We just saw, I was Googling it, and I found out that Fargo Public Schools uses it pretty pervasively in their stuff as well. So it's used all over. And in addition to to the IEEIA model, Trudy is also on a team of prominent researchers who are working on assessing environmental literacy at a national scale. And so also presenting with Trudy is going to be Dr. Bill McBeth, associate professor professor of education from the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. So Bill, in addition to being, I guess, the principal investigator on the NELA project, has also chaired NAAEE's Research Commission. He was consulting editor for the Journal of Environmental Education, and he's even served a term on the EPA's National EE Advisory Council. Yeah. So Trudy, please take it away. And Bill, are you going to come on up too? Or
I'll come up and support in whatever way I can.
Okay, great. Thank you, Trudy. And just so you know, then after Trudy and Bill, we're going to have another one of our Q&As and working sessions.
Okay. I was also a middle school science and language arts teacher, too, but that was a long time ago. So, but that's how I started. We've gone around, we've gone back and forth on what we're going to present today. We're trying to get a handle on what you are trying to do here, so we wanted to tailor it as much as we can. So I'm going to be talking about IEEIA. We're going to be looking at what elements seem to contribute to citizenship behavior, and talk a little bit about what we've learned from working with teachers and students about those elements. So what I want to do is to show how they interact with each other, because there definitely is a synergistic effect. What we're talking about is this holistic approach, the word that we've heard several times, and I hope I can help you understand that a little bit. I want to go to the first. This is a slightly adapted version of the model that Harold Hungerford and I put together back in 1990. How many are familiar with this? Okay, looks like a little over half. Good. What we've done here is to pull out the elements that we think are most prone to movement through education, and that's what we're going to focus in on. The model itself was based on really three sources, and one of them was the meta-analysis that Dr. Jody Hines did. I think that was about 86 or so. And she went into the literature at the time and looked, she wanted to meta-analyze all of the research done on responsible environmental behavior and try to come up with a model. And so that's what she did, and many of these things were incorporated into it. The model still holds amazingly. There was a meta-analysis conducted about 4 years ago, and they wanted to replicate and then extend it, and they found out that in the replication that it still holds for the relationship she had found for the most part. So we used that from Jody. We used a set of studies from some researchers who looked at precursors or predictors of environmental education, and they used the same literature that was extant at the same time as Jody was doing her work. So this was Archibald Sia, Dan Seebeck, and Tom Marcinkowski. Those names may be familiar to you. But they went into the literature to see among groups of people what variables have the strongest relationship to responsible environmental behavior. So we could say they may be predictors of it. We used one other source for this model, though, and that was instructional research. And what we wanted to do was to look at instructional research at the time, whose instruction aimed toward elements of the model. So although we called it a model for environmentally responsible behavior, you have to understand that it is really sort of an educational model for environmentally responsible behavior. So, you'll notice that the model focuses on environmentally responsible behavior. So we move from right to left Two, environmentally responsible behavior. When we refer to environmentally responsible behavior, not all people refer to the same thing, first of all. And I, when I went back to, when I went back to look at more previous models, I'm finding talk of ecological behavior, pro-environmental behavior, responsible behavior, green behavior. So there's a whole series of things now. Among the pro-environmental models, they speak only to direct action, many of them. So and when they're talking about direct action, positive physical actions taken with respect to the environment, they're talking about what we call in our work eco-management. So these are direct interactions between a person and the environment, recycling, riding a bike instead of driving to work, conserving resources, turning off the lights between the legal room, setting the thermostat on high or low depending on the season, ecological restoration projects. But we also include among our conceptualization of responsible behavior, we also include indirect action. And these are actions that are aimed not directly at the environment, but directed aimed at something else, at our infrastructure, at our social structure, to bring about a positive action within the environment. So we look at things like persuasion, consumer action, political action, legal action. These are the broader citizen actions. Now, I think this becomes important for you as you approach what you're looking at in terms of stewardship behavior. Are you going to be aiming at students doing projects which are associated with direct action? Are you going to be aiming beyond that? As lifelong learners, we hope that people move beyond that. And so in all of our work, we have struggled to deal with youngsters as citizens and help them to think about and learn and carry out citizenship behaviors, including direct action, or as we call it, eco-management behaviors. So we have a bigger pie than just the direct action ones. Okay? I wanted to make that clear.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Do you see a connection between the two? Does one lead to the next?
No, not necessarily. The issue or problem tells you which kind of action you need to take. Many issues or problems, many problems are ones that I can directly impact and I can recycle. However, I could also work to get a recycling situation set up in my community, and if I do that, many more people can recycle.
Something like a point source pollution issue, that takes a little more sophisticated action than an eco-management kind of tactic. So it really does depend on the nature of the issue.
Generally, your eco-management or your direct actions are going to be smaller in geographic scope. Their impact is going to be more limited. And as you join and work with others and work more collectively, you're going to have a bigger impact in terms of what you accomplish environmentally.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking there seems to be a hope, or I don't know if it's part of the hoop thing, that the more success you have in doing maybe a smaller direct action, that would increase somebody's feeling of, you know, self-efficacy, and then what might lead them to doing other actions.
There might be.
Wondering yeah. about that might have a broader, more indirect action.
There might be.
I don't even know if there's literature to support that.
There is. And that's similar to locus of control. And it's going to come in down in the third column. You'll see that.
Yeah, I think it's similar to transfer, too. And I don't know the transfers directly identified here, but multiple and varied experiences will lead to transfer from one situation to another, the learning or the actions. I think sometimes we forget that as educators, that what we really want out of our education system is students to take what they're learning, what they're doing in the classroom or in a classroom-related setting to their lives in general, outside of the classroom. And that, you know, to me, that's one of the ultimate goals of education. So multiple varied experiences and, you know, mindful reflection is the key there, allows that to occur rather than doing something over and over and over again. So you can pick up garbage all you want. That doesn't necessarily mean that's going to lead to different types of actions. It means somebody becomes a pretty good garbage picker up.
Okay, was there another question before?
Well, I was just going to say that there was an interesting report a few years back by WWF United Kingdom called Weathercocks and Signposts, and it was about this exact issue. They called it the foot in the door hypothesis, that if you get students to take one environmental action, or just people, then it should blossom into more. And they reviewed literature on that, and they find there's no consistent evidence to back that up.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the model here. You'll see that there are, as I said, we have movement. We have movement from the left to the right through entry level, through ownership, through empowerment, and to environmentally responsible citizen behavior. Within each of the categories or each of the levels, there are two or three elements, variables, that I'm going to be talking about. And there's a synergistic action going on within each of the categories then. And so in the first two categories, in the first category, we have the entry-level variables, ecological foundations, and environmental sensitivity. Now, I left those as ecological foundations because that's what we put down in 1990, but we talk about systems approaches. You could put marine science, you could put climate science, you could put, if you want to limit your students to climate issues, that you could have climate science, whatever. The thing is that entry level needs to have some knowledge. The link between knowledge and behavior is very weak. All of the models show that the smarter you are or the more you know does not necessarily lead you to act in a more environmentally responsible way. So why do we put it there? We put it there because it is so important to be able to make sound decisions. You got to have the knowledge to make the sound decisions, and that's where we're aiming down the line. So ecological foundation, we think, is ecological knowledge is fundamental. Environmental sensitivity is fundamental. And environmental sensitivity is was recognized from early on as a prerequisite variable. Before I worked with Harold Hungerford, and he was working with a number of other people, he came out with the goals for curriculum development in environmental education. There is no goal that is aimed at sensitivity. But the writers themselves acknowledged that this was a prerequisite goal, that this was a precondition to people being willing to work toward environmental remediation. And so they included it, but they didn't quite know how to deal with it. They said, we really don't know what it is, but we're going to include it as a prerequisites goal. One of Harold's students, Nancy Peterson, stepped up and said, I'm going to find out what it is. And about that time, a number of other people did too. And so the work of Tanner and Peterson were the first two studies in the U.S. who looked into environmental sensitivity. And the work has been replicated other places in the U.S. It's been replicated within the United Kingdom, within Norway, within El Salvador. And the interesting thing is that when they look at environmental sensitivity, they find very similar results in all of those different countries, all of those different cultures. What both Tanner and Peterson set out to do was to find out what they did not try to measure environmental sensitivity. They tried to find out what brings about environmental sensitivity. And they went to people who had either, by choice of career or avocation, showed that they were concerned and interested in the environment. So I think Tom Tanner's sample included officers of National Audubon and Wildlife National...
Sierra
Club, yes. National Wildlife Federation, some of the big organizations. Nancy went to professional environmental educators, and they simply asked them a series of questions. I'm ahead of myself a little bit. Basically, what they said to them was, how did you get that way? You're environmentally sensitive? How did you get that way? I think they asked them, I think Nancy said, how environmentally sensitive are you? And I think the answer was, on hers, was on a scale of 1 to 10, the average was 8.6. Okay? All right, so how did you get that way? Whoops, sorry, next. Missed that slide. Go to the next one. How did you get that way? What are the factors, what major factors or experiences develop environmental sensitivity? What Nancy found out, the most frequent response was that individuals had spent significant time as youth in the outdoors, and it was most often spent alone or with one or two friends. Oh, the person might report, I went out alone, I took my dog with me, we just messed around out in the orchard. I don't know how many of you might have had those experiences growing up. I hope many of you did. But that is a key contributor. I think it was like 82% of the respondents said that. Sometimes the time in the outdoors was on family vacations and outings, and many respondents mentioned that their families were sensitive, that they saw familial sensitivity. Sometimes it involved hunting or fishing or other outdoor activities, and a sizable number mentioned youth organizations or group camping. And many also identified important role models, parents and grandparents, teachers, and youth leaders. Some mentioned books and authors that they admired, and some referred to habitat alteration or the loss of a natural area where they were familiar with or they frequented when they grew up. Now keep in mind, this is the thing that amazes me, is that when they went to other professionals, other people who work with the environment in those other nations, those other settings, and they asked them the same questions, it was pretty well consistent across the board. These are the things that bring about environmental sensitivity. Yes?
I'm just curious about the survey. So these responses are self-reported?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they were all self-reported. Tom sent letters and asked them the questions and did follow-up letters. Nancy sat down in an interview situation and then could delve into their answers. I don't know how Louise did it. Louise Chawla followed up, and I want to say that she did interviews, but I'm not sure.
I'm almost positive she did interviews.
So it's no, yeah. If you don't know much about a characteristic, you go to the people who have the characteristic and say, how'd that come about? I mean, this is really ground level stuff. They couldn't measure because they didn't know what to measure. Okay? So these are all the things that bring about. Well, they give us some real important educational implications though, in terms of how we want to bring about environmental sensitivity. Do we want to bring about environmental sensitivity? In the research that dealt with predictors and precursors of responsible environmental behavior, environmental sensitivity was one of the most significant precursors of all. It was significant across Archie's samples were people at an elder hostel, at a nature-centered elder hostel experience, and Sierra Club members. Dan Sivek looked at people who might be considered consumptive of the environment. He looked at Wisconsin trout fishermen, duck hunters, and trappers. And in all of those people, environmental sensitivity was a significant contributor. I believe in Dan's sample, the ones who had the greatest correlation were the trap hunters, the trappers. They're the ones who had the strongest affinity, sensitivity toward the environment, although when you think in terms of consumptive, at least the action that a trapper does is a bit more extreme than a fisherman or a duck hunter in some ways. Well, maybe not. Well, at any rate, Tom Marcinkowski also looked at predictors, and environmental sensitivity didn't show up in his group. Well, it showed up very low. But Tom went to people who were all involved in very environmental organizations. They were environmental advocates. and their sensitivity was so high overall that there wasn't enough variance for it to show up as a predictor. So, is environmental sensitivity something we need to attend to? Probably. How do we go about doing it? Here are the educational implications.
Keep going.
Something is missing. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
There it is.
There we go.
Ah, I knew it was there. Okay, so we want to start at a young age. To gain the greatest degree of sensitivity, the EE program should start teaching participants at a young age. The preschool and elementary years appear to be important stages in which environmental attitudes are formed, if youngsters are afforded opportunities to do so. On average, Peterson subjects reported that their environmental sensitivity was in place at about age 12. Now, don't think that the window closes there. But the early years are the best place to get it in place and foundational. You can continue to gain environmental sensitivity. It can be nurtured and fostered up through the adult years, and our environmental programming should also work on doing that to catch those who might not have developed it, but also help to develop it for those who have it. 82% of Peterson's respondents reported that they thought environmental sensitivity came about because of their time in the outdoors. 78% of Tanners felt that. Frequent contact with natural areas or open spaces seems to be necessary then for this development. I would think the meaningful watershed experience would seem to be a strong entry for this sensitivity, but so would school gardens, and so would natural areas near the school, so would parks. So think on how to capitalize those, especially as you want this to be an ongoing part of the school instruction. So it needs to be something that the students can access rather easily. Interaction with natural areas often results in greater understanding of nature and an emotional bond with those specific areas. Frequent trips to nearby open spaces or nature areas should be an integral part of the EE program. School students should be allowed to interact with nature alone and in small groups. So a lot of field trips, we take a group of kids out and we put them through the stuff and then we bring them back. And yet it's the time alone when you can sit and think, when you can sit and study an acorn or a twig. Those are important times as well.
You know, so you think about the interdisciplinary approach that we could take all across, but in particularly at the elementary levels, you know, reading books, having students just do different projects outside, getting outside experiences, artwork, writing, you know, basic writing assignments, any of those things, all impact sensitivity.
Role models appear to be as equally important in developing environmental sensitivity as spending time outdoors. I think I don't know how many, I think 68% of them mentioned role models as being important. The EE program should provide opportunities for youngsters to interact with environmentally concerned and active individuals. You know, these should be people who have made vocational and avocational choices related to the environment. So certainly natural resource people to come in and talk with the kids, but also people who may be hunters or fishermen. If you can get some local retired person, someone who will come in and work with the kids on tying flies or teaching them how to cast into the local river or whatever, you know, you're going to go a long way to get some strong role models going. Teachers appear to have a profound effect on the development of environmental sensitivity. In fact, there are more of the respondents named teachers as role models than they did their own family members. the teachers constituted the greatest percentage of the role models named. They think they stimulate interest in environmental systems, and they provide educational and professional guidance. Oftentimes, the teachers develop a close relationship with the students. The students would report, the respondents reported, a favorite teacher and what they learned and how concerned that person was for the environment. So they remember those things, and they become their touchstone. We need to provide youngsters throughout their schooling with teachers who demonstrate a high level of sensitivity, are able to communicate this sensitivity to learners, and are willing to both lead students through outdoor experiences designed to promote this variable, and to lead them to aesthetic environmental experiences via books. They said books, okay? I'm adding books, television, and other media. And to permit time and space for student reflection on nature and the natural world to make sense of their experiences. Both Peterson and Tanner reported an interesting thing, and that was the personal loss of a natural area. About 24%, for both of them, 24% of the respondents said that they had lost a natural area, that loss promoted their sensitivity. They suffered from the loss, and it promoted their sensitivity. That's probably more a problem now than it was 30, 40 years ago. I mean, we're losing much, much more to residential and commercial. Focusing the EE program on local issues or problems may exert a more powerful influence on the development of environmental sensitivity than if you focus on issues or problems outside of your community. So the kids, if the kids have a bond, it's going to push them toward some sort of an emotional attachment, which may help them move them along in terms of the behavior on the line. Books were identified as influential by the individuals in the early studies. These were the children of the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s in those studies. I did the math. I was amazed. 30s, 40s, and 50s. Today's youths are probably influenced by newer technologies and media. But still, nature-oriented books, along with magazines, television programming, DVDs, other media, may enhance the development of environmental sensitivity for some individuals. And it's probably good if they include not only nature subjects, but also they show environmental heroes, that they show people who are involved in working with animals, in working with habitat, in doing things positively toward the environment. And certainly, more mature students should be provided with philosophical works related to the natural environment. A number of these adults in Peterson and Tanner's study mentioned people like John Muir, I'm drawing a blank, Rachel Carson, you know, so they had their environmental heroes, and we certainly have them and more recent ones as well. Peterson's sample especially pointed to the importance of familial sensitivity, and this is something I think we should really be working on. I think we need to involve families in sensitivity. Nature centers and parks, zoos, aquaria, and museums working with schools, or just working in their own programming, can contribute to environmental sensitivity by providing experiences directly to youngsters and to families. Events and activities planned for families and cross-generational groups both can promote sensitivity through direct experiences and through the provision of role models. Community and family gardening, hiking, fishing, other outdoor pursuits provide settings in which youngsters can spend time in the out-of-doors with those who are important to them. Now, the important thing about sensitivity is that it appears to have aspects that are experiential, affective, and cognitive. And in fact, Tom Tanner and Nancy both thought that the sensitivity seemed to want the students to learn more about the environment, to learn more about it. So that's one of the reasons that it is coupled there with ecology. You know, teaching kindergarten, first grade, second grade science out of doors on a daily or several times a week basis would be a wonderful thing to do, both to help them learn the content better and to promote their environmental sensitivity, to help them develop that bond with the out of doors. Okay, any questions about sensitivity before we move on? Let's go on to the ownership variables. The ownership variables, and when we put together this model, Harold was contacted by a UN official. They were having a world conference, and they wanted him to come and speak about what we've learned about what research tells us about responsible environmental behavior. So he and I sat down and we put together a really great researchy paper and we sent it off to them, and we felt good. We were going to sit back and wait for the conference to come. And a couple months later we got a response from them, and they pretty well said, "Are you kidding? We want the people to be able to understand this. Make it real." Which caused us to rewrite it and to make it real so that people could understand. And it also caused us to think it through a little bit better, too. I think that often happens. So what we thought looked like ownership variables would be knowledge of environmental issues, problems, issues, and solutions, I would say, skill in identifying issues, and these would include identifying, analyzing, investigating, and evaluating environmental problems, issues, and their solutions. And then personal investment. That personal investment came from some of the literature at the time. Before individuals can engage responsibly in citizenship behavior, they must understand the nature of the issue and its ecological and human implications. Without these understandings, the result tends to be uninformed action or a willingness to go along with the most persuasive argument, regardless of ecological or human consequences. So issue knowledge, like ecological knowledge, is a necessary condition to sound decision-making. The ownership variables make environmental issues important on a personal level to an individual. When individuals have an in-depth understanding of issues, they appear more inclined to take on citizenship responsibility toward those issues. And an effective way to gain an in-depth understanding of environmental issues is through critically considering them. So, what we think happens is this. When the student becomes interested in an issue, and we've given them the tools to understand the issue, their interest spikes even more. We set up a framework that lets the student look at the issue from the standpoint of what it is, who's involved, what's driving their involvement. We ask them to listen to the different voices in the issue. So we ask them to consider the varying sides to the issue. But beyond that, we ask them to choose an issue and investigate it, to go out into the community and find out what do people know, what do they think about, what do they do related to this issue. Now, once the students do that, they are investing time and effort. Once they do that, they often have their own idea about it. They start listening to other ideas. And often, as they do these surveys, questionnaires, or opinionnaires, they become engaged in conversation with the takers of the surveys, questionnaires. They always would come back and say, "This took so much longer than I thought because all they wanted to do was talk." And we all like to talk about our opinions. But what the students do then is to get a picture of the issue as it lays out in their community. So it's not something they read in a book. It's not something that they read, this person says this and this person says this, but I like the way this person writes, so I'm going to go with this. They really get to listen to all other sides of the issue. In one of our teacher trainings, we had a teacher who came back. And she and two colleagues were looking at the issue of the northern spotted owl. We were up in Washington, and they were out interviewing timbermen. And she came back and she said two things. She said, "That's the first time I ever spoke to somebody who was a timberer." And she said, "I've heard his side of the story. I don't think I'll ever be able to look at this issue the same way again." So she gained a better understanding of the issue. What this gives us then is some hope toward an issue resolution down the line if we can see the other side, the other side's interest, their concerns, and hear what's driving their part of the issue.
True, you might mention that we've tried to measure issue knowledge of environmental issues. Really difficult thing to do. Use the cause and effect format, and a couple of us could do it. I mean, when we tried to get inter-rater reliability, it was, besides the two of us, we really fleshed it out. Really, really difficult thing to do. And so while we think it's really important in terms of literacy and definitely important in terms of environmentally responsible behavior, really, really tough thing to measure.
Yes.
Can I ask a quick question about that comment? As you're talking about this, so a couple of things are going through my mind, and one is the current existence of highly opinionated social media opportunities in today's day and age that are often perceived as a source of information that's issued, you know, legitimate, mm-hmm. necessarily, just maybe just someone's opinion. And how is that factoring into some of this in this investigation model these days? And also, the political arena, there are think tanks out there that work for both sides of the argument that are looking at how issues drive people's behavior and their decisions, particularly from a voting perspective. I mean, do you think there's research out there or a formula or a type of research technique that might be translatable with environmentally responsible behavior measurement? I mean, in terms of how to measure what you were saying is really challenging to measure, I imagine. The different committees that are out there or the conventions that are out there or people are driving voting numbers are looking at the same kinds of things but not necessarily specific to the environment. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think it makes sense. I think that when Bill was talking about trying to measure this knowledge of issues, we literally would ask the students, and this was an open-ended, you know, paper and pencil instrument, we literally said, name three issues that you are aware and be sure that you include a cause and effect. So, I'll give you an example here. Deforestation due to habitat alteration due to the Keystone Pipeline.
Groundwater contamination.
Right.
And four extra points would be in Nebraska. You know, if they, the more specific and the more cause and effect related, factually, as far as we could figure out, we don't have a political agenda other than education. But I understand completely what you're saying. So
now, the problem is, it's difficult to measure. It's worth measuring. But when you're going to be administering this to large numbers of students,
In a specific amount of time, and it's only one of the components, as far as we're concerned, that lead to environmental, what we call environmental.
That's why that question was on an earlier version of the MSCLS instrument we used in the national study, but it wasn't in the national study. Okay? I don't know if I answered your question.
I
didn't articulate it extremely well, I know.
Was some of your question related to, in terms of issue investigation, what are quality sources, what are not quality sources?
Yeah, I think that was one part, and that was sort of separate from, you know, the other part. The other part was, you know, there's other people out there studying issues-related behavior or, you know, that are going to drive how people vote.
Mm-hmm.
And can they serve as a source of how to study it better, maybe, for environmental behavior?
Possibly. I mean, those are obviously, there's a very definite political agenda there. They're with focus groups trying to figure out the best way to phrase something.
Sure, that's
to get what they want.
Gotcha.
And what we want is an environmentally literate population. And that's not a Republican, an independent.
No, it's not.
It's a people thing. It's a global world thing. So, yeah, we could use, and we have used focus groups. Quite frankly, Nancy's wasn't with the focus group, but it was with focused interviews of people. So yeah, those are techniques that could be done and could be used.
And then my other piece was about the quality control with everything that's out there now, where people are getting their sources of information from, and how to separate fact from opinion, and not even fact, but.
What we would do there, what we do is to make sure that the student, in analyzing the issue, includes all the sides of the issue, or at least includes the major sides. So the student would write down so-and-so from the Better Business Bureau says this, write what they say, what are the values implied in what they say. And they would say, they may talk about a popular Fox News, you know, broadcaster says this. Is he a player? First of all, we want him to be a player. So is he a player, says this, and what are the values in what they say?
You know, and the nature of an issue is people disagree.
Yeah.
So what are they disagreeing on? If they're disagreeing on the knowledge part of it, where are you going to go to figure that out?
Right.
You know, for global warming, NOAA's webpage, their global climate information is one of the good sources that I would suggest students look at. But that's part of teaching, too,
sure.
is being able to discern quality information from
non-quality.
Yeah.
And I guess that's it. And I don't
want to
belabor it because I know we don't have a lot of time, but I know this has been around since the early 90s, this model, the investigation, and how has it changed today? I mean, when in 1990, we really didn't have a whole lot of opinion-driven-aided websites, and today's day and age, that's a really big, you know, piece of the picture. How has that and we can talk about it later. It doesn't have to be done anymore.
I don't think it would change the basic model. What it does is force the teacher and the student to take into account the exploding information.
Be more critical.
Okay. Which we should be doing in all areas of education. You know, what site should we be looking at? Because I could go get on there and say I'm a brain surgeon and sound like it, but not be it, and sound like it's maybe a
well. And this is this is also where you teach the student if they go to if we're looking at a medical issue and they go to several respected medical sites and they get similar information, that becomes more reliable information.
Right.
You know, so you start talking, you deal with some of that in terms of reliability of information. Any other questions? Okay.
Trudy, could I say maybe 10 more minutes and then we can go into, I'm sure, a lot of Q&A.
Sure.
And then a working session. We'll probably do, instead of a break, we'll just probably have a working session and then take a break when you need to during that.
Okay.
The other thing we should note is that they're having a little bit of trouble hearing on the webinar, so if you can just make sure to talk into the
Yep, thank you.
My best, thank you.
15.
Okay. Some of the early research, I thought this was interesting to add, some of the early research suggests that students, so we had a group, we had a class where the students were learning about a lot of issues. Then they learned about actions that they could do, and then they were given opportunities to do some of these actions, so kind of sponsored opportunities. We had another group, another class of students who did issue investigations, and then they looked at the actions possible, and then they were given opportunities to do it. Guess which class took the most citizenship behavior? The ones who had investigated their issue. So the ones who had invested the time, you know, when you talk about ownership, it takes an investment. And when you're a kid, what you're investing is your time, your effort, your intellectual activity, and you begin to own that issue. And students will come into a classroom and say to the teacher, "Did you see the 6 o'clock news last night? They were talking about my issue." The next one, empowerment variables. I told you that when Archie Sia and Sivek did their precursor research, that environmental sensitivity was a significant variable. Two other variables were also right up there with environmental sensitivity, and that was perceived action skill and perceived action knowledge. Action skill and action knowledge are strong predictors as well of citizenship behavior. And so we look at environmental action knowledge as an empowerment variable. We look at environmental action skills as an action variable. And if the student has done an issue investigation, they have the content with which to work with when it comes to environmental actions and skills. They have something that they could immediately apply that to.
And you know, that makes sense because you want to do something, but I don't know what to do. You know, help me figure out what to do. Well, this does that.
So what do we do there? We've already helped the students develop an in-depth understanding of the issue at hand. We've already permitted them to delve into it and become thoroughly familiar with its cast of characters and their motivations. We've facilitated their work as they investigated the community's knowledge, beliefs, opinions, and behaviors. Now we listen to what they recommend should be done. So the students have done the research into the issue. We say to them, what should be done, and we listen to them. We help them to critique their work. We explore with them the available action strategies that might be used to bring about appropriate resolution. We struggle with them as they strategize and evaluate the relative effectiveness of what they might do. And we encourage and support them as they carry out their action plans, as they act as citizens participating in environmental maintenance, protection, and remediation. I'm going to repeat that. We encourage and support them as they carry out their action plans, as they act as citizens participating in environmental maintenance, protection, and remediation. And I want to point out two really important things. One, they've got to move forward with the action. We can't. If we let them get this far and then say, okay, now you've got to take that action, it's not responsible environmental behavior. Oh, if it is, I'm the one responsible for it happening, right? We want them to be responsible citizens. We've got to step back and let them be responsible citizens or not.
It's got to be intrinsically motivated, not extrinsically by a grade or by somebody else forcing you to do something.
Okay. So that sort of ties in with a question that was asked before this morning as well. See what my next slide is. I need to make a decision here. Well, the educational implications then for both ownership and empowerment are to help youngsters develop in-depth understandings of local issues, permit them to work to thoroughly investigate issues and facilitate their work, listen to their recommendations, help them strategize and evaluate their action plans, and encourage and support them in their work. Okay. Want to hit the next button? Let's see. Go ahead, one more. Ah, I don't know if we have time. I'll try to hurry through this. I was also asked to talk about the evaluation of IEEIA, the evaluation we've done with IEEIA. And so I went back and looked over what we had done, particularly in relation to these variables. So on the left-hand side, you have the variables that we talked about, ecological or environmental knowledge, environmental sensitivity, issue knowledge, issue-related skills. Oh, the ones are on the next page. Okay. When we measured them, we have a lot of studies, but not all studies measured every variable. So when we measured them, when did we see significant differences, either in a control compare group or a pre-post situation? When we measured knowledge, we always saw a significant difference. When we measured environmental sensitivity, we never saw significant difference from the students. However, when we had teachers in workshops and asked for them for feedback, I think the average is 89% of them said that their students developed environmental sensitivity as a function of having been in the program. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. But when we looked at IEEIA and looked for environmental sensitivity, we didn't see a change. Issue knowledge, yes. Issue-related skills, yes. Critical thinking skills, yes. Personal investment, we didn't know how to measure that. Okay, next slide. Action knowledge, yes, and that was in 8 out of 8 studies. And perceived action knowledge, to what extent do you think you are knowledgeable about action? This wasn't just a single question. What we said, what John said, and then the others modeled was, eco-management is an action where you interact directly with the environment to make things better. to what extent are you knowledgeable about ecological act or about eco-management actions? And then they said about persuasion actions, and then they said about consumer actions and political actions. So it was a little bit more sophisticated than that, but action knowledge, 8 out of 8, yes. Perceived action knowledge, 6 out of 6, yes. Action skills, we haven't measured those at this point on the program. Perceived action skills, yes, in 9 out of 10 studies. Locus of control, individual, and locus of control, group, and you see some real variance there. When we try to measure locus of control, most of the time these were with 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. We're not sure how stable that characteristic is at that age. We don't know that if it has solidified. There is also research that suggests that locus of control is very issue-specific. And you think of it, you probably feel that you have a little more control over your behavior toward recycling than you do over climate change. Right? Big example. Okay, so it's not settled down. And there were two different types of treatment. One is one where the students themselves carried out their investigations on their own. The other is where it was a teacher-led class. So the student didn't have as much say in what they were doing in that case. And that might have colored it. So those are the results on there. In behavior, it was always 12 out of 12. Every time that we have used IEEIA and investigated it, that did an evaluation, we found that there was a significant change in behavior, in citizenship behavior. So that made me go back to the model. And I did call Harold last night and talk with him about this. You want to go to the next one? And it seems to me that we might have a few misnomers here that might better explain what's going on. So, at the entry level, we have knowledge of concepts and we have environmental sensitivity. And we know that comes about because of a bonding with the environment, a caring and empathetic feeling toward the environment, and it sets the stage for the later ownership and empowerment and eventually responsible citizen behavior. I think that what is happening here in the ownership is that the student, with their in-depth, where they gain an in-depth knowledge of issues through their use of their own skills, through their time and effort, develop through that kind of investment, I think what they build is a personal commitment. I think they have a personal commitment to issue solution, a personal commitment to doing something about it. I think that feeds in then the next step where we have the environmental action knowledge. They learn the strategies at their disposal in our society for helping to bring about change. They have the skills. And I think then that builds into a personal responsibility and that moves forward. Now, I'm excited about figuring out if we can measure personal responsibility and personal commitment. Okay, I think that's it.
just a couple of things to support what Trudy said. I really, really believe that environmental, or that behavior is developmental in nature. You know, we wouldn't, this model works for fifth graders all the way up through adulthood. But not so much with younger kids. There's also a difference between how you would behave or the things you would investigate with older students who are more abstract than with younger students who are more concrete. So I think it's really pretty important to understand your audience and educationally what we can and what we can't do with these students, because if we try to do this at too young an age, everybody's going to be frustrated and it may actually turn kids off. Something that isn't in the model, but is in the MIWI model, is reflection. You've got it as the third stage. And I've been working personally on reflection a little bit at the university, and there's a couple points I'd like to make on that, is it should be infused throughout the model, okay, not just at the end. And you can't ask students, well, what did you think? That's not reflection. That's not going to lead to quality reflection. Students at the university I work with don't know how to reflect in a quality way. Because if you ask them to reflect on their teaching, they'll tell you what they did, which is just a recounting of the experience that they had. It doesn't tell you why they did what they did, why they chose one action above another action, or doesn't tell, they don't explain to you the theories behind their action. You have to teach them how to do that. So reflection is a taught skill. It's a taught cognitive skill, not something that comes naturally to most students. So keep that in mind in these models. You can't take reflection for granted. I think it's really, really important.
So are there any questions for Trudy and Bill?
You use the term citizenship behavior frequently, and then you talk about personal responsibility. I'm curious, there are overlaps with service learning, and then there's also a, I don't know if it's annual, but it's some sort of a regular assessment of citizenship. I don't know what the term is, but it's done by the National...
An annual survey.
The Corporation for National Community Service, where they're assessing the level of citizenship behavior, citizenship skills among, you know, the population, and I think they do it for youth and then young adults and adults. Is there any correlation between this work and what you know of that work?
I don't know. No, I don't know of that work. I'd be very interested in looking into it, but I don't know of that.
If you're interested in the citizenship behavior thing, I'm excited to say that we have an article coming out in environmental education research where we look at, there's a huge body of literature in political science, as well as in education, on what predicts like voting behavior, joining political groups, or volunteering in politics and all that. And we identified some factors that seem to be important based on, you know, no studies we conducted, but just looking at the range of studies, and certainly things that will come up during this process, like discussions were extremely important, being surrounded with peers that have like-minded kind of ideas. So we have a framework on that. Unfortunately, I don't have it with me, but we were able to identify some variables that were very important in determining subsequent political behaviors.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like we have some wonderful opportunities here in the Bay Watershed. It's so wonderful to have these great researchers here. You know, you take a look at the opportunities, say, you know, with Maryland, with the high school graduation requirement, or Virginia Beach with the kind of really fascinating systemic program we're working on. I'm interested in the IEEIA model and kind of to what extent can we look at that and try to apply that to some of the systemic models we have here. And a couple of questions that come up immediately. You know, if you look at the high school level for starters, where do you see IEEIA if we break things down to disciplines, which is how we kind of inherently kind of look at things or inherit things? Where does IEEIA, where do you see it most effective? What discipline?
Well, I think in Maryland now it is incorporated into the environmental science. Am I correct there?
Yep. That's correct.
Yes. Okay. And I think that probably is the most appropriate because it is, I think environmental science is flexible enough to allow it. I mean, you certainly have science. And, you know, traditionally, where does EE go? It goes into the science teacher. But there is so much of the language arts in it. There is so much of the social studies in it. And if we could get at the team, if we can get at the high school level to do some team teaching, that would be ideal. But if you have to put it into one area at this point in time, I would say it would be environmental science.
You know, one of the problems when something is multidisciplinary or cross-disciplinary is nobody completely owns it. You know, and so, well, I can't do it. I've got all this other stuff to do. I would love to see it be standalone, quite frankly. Then you know it's going to get done. Where if it's shared or if it's infused across multiple areas, you've got to find the teacher. You got to find the teacher who has the passion, like we talked at that table, and believes in this kind of education, which is not an easy kind of education because they haven't experienced it themselves. And until we get to be the norm where teachers have experienced critical thinking, they've experienced an education that gives them the freedom to take a look at issues, but it's a difficult process to do. And Boris or Michela brought that up, that teachers need to experience through their in-services, through their professional development, what we want them to do. Until we get that, it's a crapshoot whether it's actually going to get done, how often it's going to get done, and where it's going to get done, because you're going to rely on those passionate teachers, those few passionate teachers.
Often when we've done teacher workshops, we've encouraged teachers to come in teams, so that from the same grade level, they would have a science teacher and a reading teacher, English teacher, or a science teacher and a social studies teacher, so that they would have the expertise from those two areas to support each other back at the school. But that becomes so variable also. It simply does get most people outside of their comfort zone. And you mentioned the necessity for in professional development for the teachers to experience the model of what they're going to be doing in the classroom. And at that point, at the end of our training, when our teachers would plan for implementation, if they didn't have a partner teacher with them, oftentimes that's when they would identify. There's one of the English teachers who's more flexible and I think might work with me on this. Okay, so then they would start looking for ways to get it in.
Do you know how it's happening in Pennsylvania? I mean, there's environment ecology standalone standards that are taught and tested. I don't know if that generally falls to an individual discipline or science generally or.
Science and technology, environment ecology.
No, civics and government is very much what your question was very poignant, because what we see happening in a lot of the civics and government standards is that's where this type of process is addressed. Mm-hmm. And if we can then marry the civics piece with the science piece, would be a very good combination. But we see those silos, like you were saying, so set up. But the process itself, we the people, is something all of you can get. You know, it's a nationally known a product that's basically the same thing that Hungerford and Trudy have developed. And that model is a citizenship model. But the kids then focus on, a lot of times, they'll pick the environmental issue to use in that model. And that bridge of trying to get it across the disciplines is very important. And the process is just as important as the content. You know, it's almost more important, really, because the process should lead you to find the content in a way. So
yes. The
process should be maybe what we need to address, like the process of all these ways of investigative skills and critical thinking skills and the models, you know, are probably what we're doing. And in Pennsylvania, we try to do this across the board, but you know what's driving it will be in 2016, we're going to be testing for civics and government. It was put on the back burner because of funding. When we see that happening, though, civics does address all the needs of communities, the needs of the natural resources. All that's written in the civics, but we don't look at those because we think we're environmental science teachers. When you look at the civics standards, can you read something and know what's truth or not? Can you listen to something on television and discern? That's a sixth grade standard. And those are really strong environmental. And I think we're on to the right process here. I think we have to look at that holistic, like we use that word, discipline, of how do we merge these pieces and not be too isolated when we talk about environmental science, because the process is what's important.
So let's go, Robin, Mel, and Abby.
Oh, I didn't need that.
It's just for the webinar.
Yeah, just for the folks in the webinar. otherwise, they cannot hear us.
I got one of those teacher voices. A concern when we think about it as a standalone is, especially in high school, when do you teach it? Right now, as we're taking a look at next generation science standards, we need to be concerned with the life sciences, the physical sciences. Is that going to be broken into chemistry and physics to do it justice for the students who are going to go on to higher ed? And then earth science. So if it becomes a standalone, when would students take it? And if we have so many requirements that students never get to have choice on, wow, I'm interested in this, I'd like to take these electives,
then when do students take it? I mean, how many science requirements are we going to have for them? That's a real question, and it brings its own problems. Who was next?
Melanie.
I have hope for the IE model, because right now in science, at least in our county, project-based learning is part of requirement. I mean, that's what they're doing. It's not all the way, but it's the beginning. If you look at the IB programs, the International Baccalaureate programs, middle year programs, Project Citizen, and middle school, all of those follow a very, very similar program in regards to following that model. A lot of those are being applied to the environment. I mean, good. It's there. It's actually in the curriculum in some way, because they're having to learn the process. It may not always be environment, but it wouldn't take much to edit. Yeah. For sure. So I think there's hope. I think it's in there. I think there's different places where it's being directly done. STEM also follows a very similar model. You know, they don't get to the action part.
Yes.
That's where we kind of need to tag on to. But it's there. The process is there. I think at least the pieces of it are. Yeah. And I think it's just building on that.
Abby? Donald wants to chime in so bad. Abby.
Thanks. Just really briefly, this is something that's on my radar. I'm not an expert on it, but the Next Generation Science Standards, which you mentioned, I encourage you to kind of take a look. I think it's coming up for another public review shortly. They're really pushing for a lot of this integrated interdisciplinary approach. I think the wording to still out, how it's going to come together, how it's going to play out. We're still just in the framework phase. Standards are being written, following it loosely at the moment, but I think it's something to keep an eye on, and I'd be curious at some point to hear how this aligns with what their approach is. There's a lot of difficulties I've heard raised today that are very similar to difficulties folks are expecting with the approach that they're aiming for. So,
and so
with classroom work.
And so we can table that, certainly for tomorrow when we talk about, I know Laura's going to talk about Next Generation and sort of how environmental education can confuse into that priority. All right, Don, and then we're going to have a break/working session.
Thank you. A comment to Trudy and a question to Bill. But Trudy, first of all, thank you, because your groundbreaking work on this. You know, I just know at the Bay Foundation, we spent tens of millions of dollars on your model.
I spent it on the models, not on us.
Travel.
Yes.
So the question to Bill is kind of looking, as your literature research now, looking forward to the future, is this still going to be the model? I mean, do we, in the next 10, 20 years, do we invest similarly in a model like this?
No, the beauty of this, well, I mean, this or the IEIA model?
This model. So the way they looked at the literature research, going back to look at the predictors of environmental behavior change, is that still going to be more or less the model for behavior change in the future?
I think so. I think there'll be some additions. I think the more, once we find out more through research, you know, some of the people in this room are on that track right now and can add to the model. I think, you know, we don't know everything we need to know about environmental responsive behavior. So the answer is probably will change, but fundamentally I think the framework is going to remain the same. There'll just be some additions or refinements to it once we find out more.
But I think the important thing is, and I hope the thing that doesn't change, is what we are educating for. And that is for a citizenry that is concerned about the environment and that is able and willing to enter into working toward a quality environment. And we don't want automatons that are marching for, you know, a hopeful world. We want thinking people. Because if we surveyed all of us in here on some very specific issues, we would not find 100% agreement. That agreement is healthy. But we want thinking citizens. That's what we want the product to be.
You know, one of the real cool things, though, is not so long ago, if we'd have been really discussing behavior change, we would have been in trouble. Mm-hmm. I mean, people didn't talk about education being something to help change behaviors. I mean, you're advocating, you're rooting, you know, bad environmental educators. But now it's become an acceptable term, and we fully understand that education is about trying to help people understand what the expectations are. Now, how they can get there, there are multiple ways to get there. So we're not trying to create robots, but we are trying to help people learn that there are certain expectations in the society as a society, as a global society. And I think that's a very, very positive step that we've taken in the last 10, 15 years.
And on that note, we're going to have our working sessions at our tables. It'll take about 15 minutes. People might need to get up, walk around, get some coffee, use the bathroom. Shannon's pointed at something.
I want you to just tell the webinar people when to join back.
Oh, 15 minutes?
15 minutes. All right.
Knock this out, Bart. All right.
Are you still on note duty?
I'm still on note duty. Oh, right. We have the expert right at the table.
That helps.
She should be able to just go right down and tell us what to check and not check.
Expert has to go make a quick phone call if she can find her phone. There it is. She will be right back.
Are we okay going the same way?
Yeah.
Talking through?
Is this your glass or mine?
I'm not even using a glass. Help yourself. So the first one about relevant to specific learners at a particular level.
The next one as well.
Yep,
I have that. I think guided by the learner's interest, they can even talk about that.
It's essential for buying.
The teacher training, is that a big part of it? I mean, I think it's implied that the model, or the approaches and best practices around teacher training. And based on the program, they do offer training. programs, and they have teacher trainers around the country who have been trained on and this is another training. Teachers should receive training in field-based pedagogical skills appropriate to their level of instruction.
Same response as the last one.
I would be. Yeah, because when she states about how powerful it is and that the student saying the teacher being that model was such a often common answer for the students, and you think the teacher's got to be knowledgeable, the teacher's got to be demonstrating this.
Didn't you skip ahead?
Oh, I didn't do the back. Sorry, good facilitating.
We're all lost. I was like, where did he get those words?
Back to the first page. Okay. And then we'll go on to the third page where we just were.
Yeah. Okay. That's why I said the same answer as before.
Yeah, that was an essential part of the model.
But again, you're going to teach a training thing in there.
I think that's where all this, like, this, we're dealing with teachers and what teachers need. So this is an essential part of their program.
They were really talking about, in her study, she's discussing what do students need, not what do teachers need. So, where they need to grow from that. Exactly. You know, I guess she could say, well, it was a contract of bodies, but is that accurate?
So we're on our little challenge.
You know, just because of institutional knowledge about this program, I've heard of both work.
Exactly, but I guess my point is, isn't it our job to take all the institutional knowledge and then use that knowledge to then come up with the end product? So if we're implying something about somebody's work and studies that and will we be able to take the body of work tomorrow and be able to use it to create a document that truly represents all of the research that is taking place?
And you're, I mean, I think everything that Trudy talked about was all students, right? All students. So there's no real teacher training part of what she spoke about.
So therefore, it could be recommended, but is it in the essential
I see what you're saying. I totally get that. So my interpretation of that is that, like, so because it wasn't explicit that teacher training, this is essential teachers are trained on this. Yeah. It's more like because students need to know about it, we recommend that this training happens. So when it comes to developing best practices, is it essential that you're training them, i.e., you know, that?
Exactly. Or was there evidence that it's essential that it be trained?
Yes.
Your answer is not from this. There's no evidence about teachers. There's not. I think your point is well taken. But you could make recommendations. You could say, I mean, clearly that independent thinking one, you know, I'd say. Yeah. All right.
Okay, so
now we're going to
do the consensus thing.
So where do we start?
So this is the conversation we were just having. Yes, this is all because we're the teachers, we need to focus on what components of the work that's being presented. relates to each one of the topics right in the column. And so, because most of what you had to speak about was about the students, and what moves students wrong, so the behavior change model. Yeah, well, so we're going based on what we have heard, as opposed to maybe an institution that you have no about.
Okay.
But you can feel free to enlighten us.
As we
continue to go through
it. What are we on?
So we are on the third one on the second page. Teachers should receive training in environmental content knowledge for purposes of level of instruction. Am I wrong, page? Okay, start at the top of the document.
That's kind of where we got.
Did
you start?
Okay,
like, oh, yeah, they're checking.
We were talking about check-in and things. All right, we'll just go through them, because we got So back at the second page, number one. Teachers should be trained on how to enhance the ability of students to think independently about environmental issues.
In her discussion, she said that they should not be in touch. She said they should be able to think independently. However, it was never mentioned that the teacher should be trained that way. It was encouraged, so maybe we should go with recommended.
Except when I said to Michela, in our workshops, we agree with you, you have to have the component where the teacher goes through the same thing that they are going to be teaching the students to do.
So can that be a blanket statement on every one of these topics then?
Well, it can be for the first one. It's essential. It's essential that students get trained in how to enhance the ability of students to think independently.
I remember you saying several times that teachers need to go through this process.
Yeah.
Go through the whole, right. You know, this whole decision-making process.
So they understand.
So their students will learn through.
Yes. But your research work, like that, I mean, that's important in the research work you've heard about this
whole time,
that as being part of a professional development.
Yeah.
Does your work point to that to be good work?
Yes.
All right, so we're changing that too.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And I guess so that would also apply to teachers receive training on how environmental ed meets existing curriculum standards and State Department of Education. Well, you didn't talk about State Department.
I don't know that the IEEE model set that, but in order to best use it in the classroom, you're certainly going to have to be able to tie it. Or you're not going to be able to get it in the classroom.
Right, it won't be relevant.
Yeah, and that's, and see, I didn't have enough time. And in our, well, I did say, in our training, at toward the end of the week, is when we have the teachers sit down and plan for a presentation. And that's one of the things they do is, what are you going to present to your administrator as reasons that this is appropriate? So they have to look at their own state requirements and see where they're fit. But see, I didn't tell you that.
Yeah, that's the part you know. All right, how about the third one? Training in environmental content knowledge.
It's appropriate to the level of the subject.
There is an interesting study I saw at the teachers' college where they were looking at elementary science teachers, or elementary teachers teaching science, and they were looking at the immersive experiential exposure that they had to teach as opposed to content knowledge. So did they want to learn how to teach what they were going to teach, or did they want to know the content knowledge?
Yeah.
And what they found, which was counterintuitive according to that researcher I spoke with, they thought it was going to be they wanted to learn how to do it. What they really wanted was to understand and have the content knowledge, and that was
is what led them not to teach it, the same amount of passion, because they didn't feel comfortable actually understanding it. Once they understood it, we know how to teach.
They're very, yes.
But we need to, so I think, you know, in terms of the content, having that familiarity, the confidence and all of that, you know, the research there showed that's what was holding them back. They didn't want the training on the how, they were training on the what and understanding that, and that's where they had the deficit. Therefore, they were less likely to teach beyond the minimum.
Except the IEEIA thing is also, it's not about what, but it's a how to.
Yeah, I mean, there's both.
It's very much a how to, and usually at the middle school and high school level when it's taught, the teacher is not directly teaching any environmental knowledge. And they may do a brief intro, we're going to look at issues related to Chesapeake Bay, and they may do an overview of Chesapeake Bay, but then the students would have to go deeply into whatever area of knowledge they needed to make sense of their issues. Now, the teacher would have to have knowledge because she would have to be, he or she would have to be the one who could guide them to resource people or to sites for learning more information or to, a textbook or whatever they need to understand.
Some base level of knowledge in order to be comfortable allowing kids to go diving deep.
Exactly.
So that base, and depending on what level, whether it's middle school or high school,
you have to have two things. You have to have that base knowledge, and you have to have enough confidence to say, I don't know.
That's right, exactly.
Why don't you find out and tell us all?
So in terms of boxes to check there, essential, recommended, so you know about it, but it's not essential, because you need a baseline, but you don't need to know it all. You got to be able to level it off, except for the elementary thing, which is a different ball of wax. Elementary school science, they do a lot. You're not letting your brains off. Yeah, so we're on that first one on the third page.
It depends. In terms of IEEIA, the teacher is not going to need them unless he or she. IEEIA allows surveys, questionnaires, or opinionaires. And if the students want to do a survey of something, then the field-based pedagogical skills would come in as important. I guess recommended.
Next generation science standards, does that change your thinking about that? What's your recommendation? Is it essential when we're talking about practices and field-based inquiry? Being able to facilitate that as a teacher.
If you haven't been trained in that, I think that's a skill.
I don't know, because I'm unclear what things are going to be used for.
The end game is this is the set of best practices that, this is the fodder for developing the best practices that we're going to put together.
So they're saying among these speakers, what sort of...
Can you hear me clap twice? You can hear me clap three times.
No, we're not
ready.
Good job.
And still don't. It always works. All right.
People can still talk and clap.
I know. So next one, we're starting at the bottom.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll show you one.
Which one?
The last one. Training should be included at least 24 hours.
In Maryland,
it's good to be here.
Essential.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, everybody. Last session of the day. We're doing pretty good. We've got some time built in at the end. I think we go over a little bit on our report out. So we're actually doing just fine. We're gonna switch gears just a little bit, talk a little bit about community-based, school-based programs. Multiple models along those lines. I have three people to introduce. First is Dr. Rachel Becker-Klein. I want to say Becker. Peer Associates. Peer is program evaluation and educational research, so obviously right up our alley. Rachel's been with Pierce since 2005, and her work stretches across all phases of evaluation, planning and strategizing to clarify program goals, to refining logic models, developing data collection tools, then analysis and reporting, so all things education and evaluation. She served as Senior Research Associate for the evaluation of Project COSEED, community-based school environmental education, and has worked extensively on evaluations of Boston environmental education organizations. So following Rachel, we will be Bo Hoppin. Bo is a place-based education consultant with Boston Public Schools. He's worked for over 20 years to integrate environmental and place-based education into the landscape and culture of local communities and their schools. Bo founded both the Rachel Marshall Outdoor Learning Laboratory in New Hampshire and Project COSEED, which I just mentioned. Both of these programs engage students in the study of their local community and environment in a way that supported local and state curriculum. And then following Bo, we're going to have Julian Dutremont-Smith. Julian's the Chief Sustainability Officer at Alfred State College up in New York. I think Julian's presentation is going to be especially relevant to that table over there. All of us, but that table over there. And really to anyone who's associated with what we refer to as green school programs, the programs that certify or recognize schools for environmental health, student health, things along those lines. Julian's been a longtime leader in campus sustainability. He co-founded the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education, and helped create the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, as well as sustainability tracking, assessment, and rating systems. He also co-founded a social enterprise that produces biodiesel in Barbados. It doesn't have anything to do with this, but yourself. So I'll stop talking now and have the experts come on. Great job. Thank you. And all our speakers, we have to talk right into this, apparently. And also, if we go around the room and have questions, we want to make sure our webinar folks can hear. So.
Or the speaker can repeat it, whatever's easier.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Kevin. Hi, everyone. I hope we can all kind of stay awake, including me, for this part of the conversation at the end of the day with lots of information. So as Kevin mentioned, I'm coming from Peer Associates. We're a small evaluation firm. We focus primarily on place-based education evaluation programs, really all around the country. So Kevin mentioned my work with some Boston organizations, but I've also worked nationally with many different ones. And I'll be focusing on a couple of different things today, but happy to talk more about other endeavors that I've helped to look at. What I'm primarily focusing on today and talking about are two different studies. The first is a meta-analysis. That's a common theme today. When you want to get a lot of information, you go to the meta-analyses. And I'll talk more about that, but it was commissioned by the Environmental Protection Agency, National Park Service, and it was looking at whether environmental education can impact environmental quality, which is something that we haven't talked that much about today, but will, I think, has implications for what we're doing here. And then the next kind of body of research is some evaluation work that Peer has been doing with PEAK, which is the Place-Based Education Evaluation Collaborative, for over 10 years, and we have these little brochures, so I'll put them up here if you're interested. You can also find it online. I can give you that site. And that is, I'll talk more about that, but PEAK is a collaboration of several different place-based education organizations with different models. So before I get too far, I do want to talk a little bit about what is place-based education or place-based learning, and I'll call it PBE or PBL, whatever comes to mind. And I'm going to talk about some of the terminology and some of the core practices and qualities behind it. But I do also want to emphasize that whatever we call it, I think we shouldn't get too caught up in like what we call this. Because this is what people are doing, and that's the important part. We're going to get at what are the best practices and qualities of what's happening in the field. So whether you call it environmental education or service learning or place-based education, the important part is what are the components of it. So that's what I'll be getting into. But I want to kind of start off with a little bit of a shared background and shared definition. So the working definition that I have of place-based learning is that it's a holistic approach to education. You might recognize some of these terms. That uses the local community as an integrating context for learning at all ages. It fosters vibrant partnerships between schools and communities, and it boosts student achievement and improves community health and vitality. So the things that I want to kind of point out here, again, holistic approach, right? So that refers to both kind of interdisciplinary approach that we've also been talking about today, but also thinking about the whole story of what happens. So a kind of from a systems perspective. Using the local community, so really strong focus on getting students to, or people, whoever they are, whether it's students or youth, in our case, we're mostly talking about students, to focus on what do they already know. And that becomes very important developmentally, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The idea of school-community partnerships, so that could be both having schools go out into the community and also getting people and organizations from the community to come into the schools so that it really goes both ways. Project-based learning, hands-on, experiential, all stuff we've been talking about today as well, and that it's really tailored locally. So this is, again, back to the using the local community, but also that it gives back to the local community in a way that's beneficial to that. So what I'm going to be talking about now comes from the six core qualities of place-based learning, comes from this study that was done looking at environmental quality. So a few people, including Michael Duffin from Peer Associates, were involved in this study. So I didn't actually conduct the study, but I've heard lots about it. I feel like I know it very well, and I've read it many times. And you can find this on the Peer website, and I can give you the specific URL if you're interested. The idea behind this study was that they looked at, I don't remember exactly, many different studies that examined environmental education and the effects that that might have on environmental quality. They then, just to make it more kind of doable to look not at everything, they focused on studies that tried to impact air quality. So although that might not be the primary focus of what we're talking about today, the implications are obviously crossover. And so what were found to be the six core qualities of place-based learning was that it was grounded in the attributes of place. So there was a lot of use of the local, natural community, both the natural kind of environment and the built environment as a context for learning. That learning was experiential or hands-on. A lot of it takes place outside of the classroom. So that could be out in the community. It could even be in the schoolyard, but not sitting in the classroom. That learning experiences contribute to community vitality. This is something, if you're familiar with service learning, they call it meaningful service. So it's the component of not just doing something in the community that's fun for me, but doing some project in the community that gives back to the community, that helps the community in some way that is actually needed within that community. That the learning is grounded in and supports development and love of the local community. So getting back to this idea of, I don't remember, maybe Trudy mentioned that, someone mentioned about how leading, you know, the ways that you lead to kind of responsible citizenship behavior or environmental stewardship is starting with a love of your local community. That if you start with that love of your place, interest in your place, that that can lead to, doesn't always, but it can lead to being motivated to do something to help that place. And that local learning serves as a foundation for understanding regional and global issues. So this is important. From a developmental perspective, if you look at very young children, their understanding of global issues is you know, is not the same as what you can do with a high schooler. So the idea behind place-based education is not that you only stay in my local community, but that you start in the local community, especially when children are very young. And as they get older, you learn, use that as a touchstone to think more regionally and more globally. So it might be inappropriate, like when my daughter was in kindergarten, they learned about penguins in Antarctica. And it was cool, it was fun, you know, but what did they really understand about penguins in Antarctica? We were living in New Hampshire, and I thought, why don't they just go outside and track, you know, the animals that are here in winter and learn about that, because they can see it, they can understand it on a different level. But by the time she got to high school, that might have been appropriate, now that she's learned about her local animals, to then think about, well, what are the implications for other animals in other places? And finally, that learning experiences are supported by local partnerships. So again, these school-community partnerships that can be with nonprofits, with local businesses, with people and other organizations, government organizations in the community. So then there are also 12 kind of promising practices that were identified. And I think Bo is going to talk a little more about this later, about how it looks on the ground. Again, I don't want to get too much into this. It's not going to look surprising or different, really, from what we've talked about today. It might be a slightly different way of thinking about it. Learning is project-based. Again, the local community. One piece that did come up earlier that's really important for important as a promising practice is administrative support. So that is that the school administration and or the organizational administration supports project-based, place-based learning as an essential pedagogy. If that's not true, you can have the best teacher who's really totally into place-based learning, and it can't really be sustained over time. You have to have some sort of administrative support. Again, I don't think that's surprising, but you know, it's just been found over and over in the literature. I think anyone who's ever done evaluation in schools probably could tell you the same thing, and anyone who's ever taught in a school could tell you this. That is tailored to individual learning styles. And this is kind of touted as one of the really primary advantages of PBL, is that because you're not just sitting in a classroom at a desk reading a book, because you're doing project-based learning, because you're going out into the field, out into the community, there are lots of opportunities for people to learn in different ways. And that you can really tailor the learning to their individual learning styles. You really want the learning to be relevant to learners, and again, having it be in the local community by you know, the stint of having it be about their own community and their own place does make it relevant to them. And the initiated by students and driven or led by students, this is the student choice and voice thing that we hear about a lot. That's really important. It can also be, as I mentioned to someone earlier, really scary to some teachers, because if I'm a teacher and I'm not guiding the learning, if I'm allowing students to decide what they want to learn or what they want to do, then that can be scary to me if I don't know how it's going to turn out. So unless you've kind of seen it done and know that it have a sense of confidence that's going to work, that can be a hard piece for teachers to let go of that control. That interdisciplinary service learning component again, and opportunities to work both cooperatively and independently. And then the last is this reflection piece. And the reflection piece is really important. It's been brought up a lot today too, and is something that is a big part of the service learning world. Reflection really allows people to consolidate and deepen their learning. And as someone mentioned earlier, we don't get enough time in our lives to do that. But not only do we not get enough time and it does it deepen learning, but it also really has been shown to, you know, increase all sorts of the outcomes that we want to see. So I want to mention some of the outcomes that were found in this environmental quality study. So the primary finding was that education programs can improve environmental quality. In this case, it was air quality. And nearly half, 46% of all the programs that were studied, and I think there were about 60 programs, reported evidence that air quality had actually improved over the course of their projects. So there were three, they were kind of categorized into three different types of programs. One was information only, and in this type of program, they provided information, education, and about air quality, but they didn't really take any action to change that. And an example was a program in North Carolina did outreach presentations at schools and at churches about the effects of poor air quality. So they were telling people what poor air quality can do, you know, how it can be harmful. 43% of the programs did take some action, but they didn't measure changes in air quality from pre to post. So we can't say anything about whether it actually changed over that time. But one example of a program was in California, high school students monitored air quality near their school, and then they contacted local officials, they wrote to polluting industries, and they took part in press conferences. So they were doing things to try to educate about why, you know, to tell specific industries about what they need to do to change. But 46% of the program, so 25 of them, did show evidence of either physical changes in air quality from pre to post, or what they were calling proxy changes. So an example of a proxy change was that in New Hampshire, at a high school in New Hampshire, students monitored idling rates in their parking lot for school buses and cars. And then they decided there was too much idling, that was bad for the environment, and so they successfully led an effort to have a school-wide no idling policy, and they installed signs all over the grounds, and they actually stopped the buses and cars from idling. So what they didn't do was measure the air quality before and after, but they did measure that they had stopped idling, and you know, that was a proxy because there are other studies that show a direct connection between idling and pollution, air quality. An example of a program that actually did change air quality was at a middle school in Washington State. Students investigated and they looked at levels of all sorts of different indicators like carbon dioxide, mold, airflow, airborne particulates, and then they realized there were unhealthy levels of those. They worked with their school administrators to reduce those levels, and over the course of the year, when they measured afterward, they had actually reduced all of those things. So these are programs that took place in schools that were environmental education programs that had some of the components that we talked about before and were actually able to change air quality. So this, you cannot read this table, but
I have it.
But Bo has it to circulate among people if you're interested. And what I want to point out here is that, so this is a table of all of the different poor qualities and promising practices, and it shows on the right-hand side the percentage of programs that reported that as strong. So, like 89% of the programs said that they were personally relevant to learners. 85% said they were experiential or hands-on. So you can see that a lot of these programs did report many of these PBL core qualities. And the interesting thing, I think, in the study is that the programs that reported more PBL qualities and practices were more likely to report improvements in air quality, right? So the more kind of high quality a program was, defined by what we've been talking about, all these promising practices, the more they did those practices, the more likely they were to actually have an impact on environmental quality. And
I just realized the tables they have is actually one you're going to show next. It shows actually the data. But
so oh, okay. You have a slide.
The qualities aren't in the same order.
So what I have, it might not be up here, but I'm going to tell you about it. So I didn't want to put too many tables up.
So you're saying if they adhered pretty strictly to the pedagogy for best practices in PBL, then they got better environmental impact results. Is that
right. So the more PBL practices that they incorporated, and especially some specific ones that I'm going to talk about, the more likely they were to have actually impacted the environment. So the more high quality the program was based on what we're calling, you know, the quality practices. And so the two strongest predictors were including a service learning component and contributing to authentic community needs. That's not what you're gonna, what you see up here is a slightly different table, but so again, the two strongest predictors of actually changing environmental quality were including a service learning component and contributing to authentic community needs. And then other really important predictors were being supported by the administration, utilizing local partnerships, supported by the local community, and the program being experiential or hands-on. Other questions about that?
Mark? Yeah, so each of these measures, is it just binary, like present, not present, or was it a scale to what extent they included in those sort of
things? Right. So Mark's question was, were these binary, or was it a scale? And I think it was a scale. I think it was a 1-4 scale.
What would have been the indicators of strong administrative support? Did you ask
that? What were indicators of strong administrative support? I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up. It may have just been a question, you know, where we asked, do you feel that you have support for this program? So the practice implications for this are, number one, I mean, this is the whole purpose of what we're doing today, but the importance of bringing in measurement and evaluation and assessment into programs. Because you may have heard of the adage that what gets measured gets done. So if you, you know, basically part of what this study shows is kind of like a, well, of course, you know, like studies that measured it were the studies that found it. And studies that didn't measure didn't find it. But on the other hand, the studies that measured air quality were more focused on that. The participants were thinking about it more, the educators were kind of pushing people in that direction. So really having that focus and having indicators and metrics that you use to help get you there, that in and of itself can be really strong. And among evaluators, this is something that comes up sometimes that, you know, just by doing evaluation, just by doing assessment, that in and of itself does have an effect on the program and the intervention. And I think in the old days, evaluators didn't want to acknowledge that, but now I think a lot of us are fine with that. I mean, I personally think, okay, that's great. You know, if evaluation can help enhance a program, I don't think that's bad. And then the other is what I mentioned before about focusing on the educational practices, not necessarily on the what we call it. But what are the practices that lead to the outcomes that we want? So I want to actually leave that study now, even though there's a lot more we could say about it, and go a little bit to the place-based education collaborative. And again, there are brochures up here. I don't know if I'm going to pass that around or not. But so this was this brochure is based on many studies, over 10 years of studies of evaluation, looking at several different place-based education programs around the country. Some of them were a whole school model where there was something like a teacher naturalist in the school for a couple days a week, working with the students, working with the teachers, working with the administration, really trying to get place-based education integrated. COSE that Kevin mentioned before is a great example of that. Some of the programs are professional development models, which we've been talking a little bit about today, working with teachers. So for example, a forest for every classroom, and then a shoot-off of that is a trail to every classroom that works with, does professional development with teachers to try to get them to integrate either the outdoors or the Appalachian Trail specifically into their curricula. And it's both of those are pretty extensive professional development programs that have lots of follow-up and lots of hours and all of the best practices of what PD, teacher PD should be. Some of the programs are direct service with students, Nature Center working with, you know, teachers bring their students there, Nature Center works with the student. Some are a hybrid of like direct service with students and some professional development. So there's lots of different program models. And even across all these program models, our evaluation of PEAK found lots of benefits of place-based education over the years. So place-based education helps students learn, and it's not the focus of today, but you know, we could do a whole other workshop on how place-based education and other and environmental education helps with student academic engagement, gets them more interested. And you know, there's some evidence of looking at academic achievement, which is harder to measure.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious if there's an average time scale that is like is recommended or that you found place-based education programs.
Is right. So the question is: there an average time scale? Do they have to? So I mean, interestingly, I would say it depends which outcome you're looking at. So like for academic engagement. Even shorter duration programs can have an impact on students. I hear a lot of times I'll interview teachers and they'll say, oh, you know, this student never did well in the classroom and then we went out to this program and all of a sudden they realized that they could do something that they had or they thought could think of themselves as a learner and they never had done that before. And that translated back into the classroom. So you can hear that sometimes. We didn't really compare the different programs. Like the, it could be that different, you know, longer duration programs or whole school models probably have a stronger impact. We did find that the whole school model had a stronger impact for sure on inviting citizens to become active students, inviting students to become active citizens, which is civic engagement. So whole school model for sure had a greater impact on that than the teacher professional development or the direct service with students, but it really, there was a lot of variation there. Yeah. So other areas, you know, energizes teachers, can transform the school culture, connect school and communities. What I want to just talk about a couple of examples today is that place-based education can encourage students to become environmental stewards. That's what we're talking about. And the way that we have defined environmental stewardship is, I think, has to do with informed decision-making about environmentally responsible behavior. So it's a combination of environmental behaviors and environmental decision-making. So I just want to like read a couple of kind of case studies and examples. One teacher from the Forest for Every Classroom program said, I know our students are walking away from the seventh grade experience having a deep appreciation for their own environment and an intrinsic value of the public lands. They understand our responsibility to be stewards of our land and not just users of it. Then there was a group of special education students from Greenville, Maine. They organized a field research team to study the 100-mile wilderness, which is a segment of the Appalachian Trail. They produced signs and brochures for trail users, and they hiked the trail in sections over the course of the year. They were inspired to become Appalachian Trail stewards after their teacher attended this Trail to Every Classroom program. And the way that they were environmental stewards was by creating the signs and really working on the trail, maintaining the trail. So that was an example of a professional development program. Another program that's kind of a hybrid that takes direct service with students as well as some professional development. There was a school in St. Louis, Missouri that the teachers worked with their kids to create a fourth through sixth grade River Kids after school group. So it was a voluntary program. The kids could come, and they conducted a detailed river conservation study. They looked at investigated streams, and then they did stream cleanups and revegetation projects. So those are just some examples of some of the ways that place-based education can encourage students to become environmental stewards. And that's all I have to say about that.
We'll have Bo come up and talk, and then we'll take sort of questions for each of you.
Okay. Thanks, Rachel. Hi, everybody. We want to do the view slideshow.
Yep.
Get my notes off of there.
1 second.
There's all kinds of nasty comments on there. So here's Terrence. Meet Terrence. He is still a excited kindergarten student, ready to go out and explore the world and ask all kinds of questions, come up with all kinds of answers that are his own, go back into the classroom, open up books about insects, find out if some of his questions are right or wrong, go out about and look at butterflies some more, come back in and ask more questions. That's who Terrence is. So we'll talk a lot of today is about Terrence. Terrence is actually in sixth grade now. I've been working with him for a long time.
Yep.
Just which one did I push?
The arrow. Yep.
So now I'd like to introduce you to your public school educator. Like it or not, this is their reality. And like it or not, more often their reality is this and English, language arts, and math. Not even science, not social studies, and environmental science is probably, or environmental studies is way down the road. It is, right now, the monster we have to work with. Now, that may change. There's some optimistic-looking things coming around, new testing standards and all that, but that's where we are right now. And when we think about things you're going to develop, helping these folks teach ELA and math better through the work that we do is one of our main avenues in. So the exciting thing is place-based education offers an opportunity to create a more interesting vision for education. You know, one that goes beyond test scores, one that goes beyond teaching the test, one that goes beyond talking about academic achievement as a number that kids have to meet. And that's the opportunity that place-based education brings in a way that's culturally relevant to the audience that you're working with. A lot of my slides today are from an urban setting, but I worked in a rural setting way up in northern New Hampshire and Vermont as well. And Mark's definition of place-based education, that you know, it's education about a place, the piece that I would just add to it is it's education about a place in a way that's culturally relevant to the audience that you're working with. And that has, you know, one of the pieces of it that are powerful and promising for education for kids, especially kids that struggle academically. My job today is just to sort of make some of these characteristics come alive, to make some of the, I'm going to talk about some of the characteristics that Rachel just showed you, and you know, what it kind of looks like in a school. So just a kind of a note, I personally am not wedded to this idea or the terminology of place-based education. I come from an environmental education background. That's really who I am. And I think sometimes Rachel talked about this, we get caught up in all these terms, but with, you know, what's really important are the qualities of the education. And what we're really talking about is what makes for a high-quality education experience in whatever it is that we're teaching. So my job today is to sort of make some of these come alive for you, and I've broken them, all the different qualities that Rachel handed out to you on that sheet with all the fancy numbers on it, I've broken them into three categories, green schools or the schools work that these folks are all, and they all cross over in different ways, but I thought that these are maybe the places where they come into the case the most. So attachment to place, authentic community needs, support by leadership and collaboration with community. In green schools, there's been a lot of work in Boston around greening the school grounds. There's this thing called the Boston Schoolyard Initiative. It's a capital improvement project. It's a community design project that's collaborative with the community, so the neighbors get involved. They come in, they look at what the schoolyard has right now, they look at its assets, even though there might not be many. A lot of times it's removing asphalt and putting in green spaces for kids to learn in. The support by leadership is that it's coming from the mayor, it's coming from foundations in Boston, and principals have to be committed to going through the process with their schools. I too was really surprised when it had been a while since I read this research, that support by leadership ranks third on that list, of improving ability to improve environmental quality. So that, in thinking about your work, we talk a lot about targeting teachers, but maybe we need to be targeting the people who lead teachers. So this is a school redesign process. Whoops, I keep forgetting them. So this is a school redesign. This was all asphalt that you're looking at now. There's a series of platforms. These guys are studying levers and pulleys unit out in it. Here they're studying levers. And then here we involved kids. So we only did about 50% of the planting work with the redesign with the landscapers. And the kids did the rest of the work. So there's been a series of waves of kids coming in and doing planting projects, and then in some cases even designing habitats in the schoolyard. What we've noticed is that some of our kids that are most challenging in the school find the greatest successes in what they've implemented out in the schoolyard. And they're most likely to revisit it. Up in the top right-hand corner, that young lady, all of our eighth graders have to present a portfolio of their work to graduate. And this was, a centerpiece of her portfolio when she talked about service to community, was planting that little tree right there. I already mentioned this, we worked with the local neighborhoods from all around the school. There's all kinds of issues that we came up with. In redesigning the school, we were taking away parking spaces for teachers, which means the teachers were parking on the streets. And we had a huge issue come up. But because we had involved neighbors in the planning process, the neighbors that had been involved were able to talk to their neighbors and say, look, they're just, once this is all finished, there's going to be more parking spaces available, and this is going to be a resource for you. It's not just a resource for the school. The city of Boston thinks of these as neighborhood parks. All right, so I'm going to go on to piece about green schools is just, I was real quickly going to tell you the story. So a lot of urban schools have the horror stories of the ebbs and flows of recycling initiatives in their throughout the district. There's all kinds of challenges associated with it. We're back on the upswing in Boston, you're creating a curbside pickup strategy for recycling, and all the seventh graders go around and pick it up once a week. But the key is that these kids weigh it, and then that data is informing the entire Boston Public School system and their recycling efforts. We're a pilot school, and then they're going to ramp up to all the other schools in the district, and they're using the student data to help inform that process. Okay, so what I like to talk—I like to call this applied teacher professional development. The idea that any teacher here that's sitting here can tell you that the teacher professional development that they went through, certainly after they were in college, is a lousy model. It's usually sitting in an auditorium, somebody showing a bunch of slides, and then says, "Go do the work." So what we do in this school is that I'm the experiential learning director, and I meet regularly with teachers once a month for 3 hours to think about their units that they're planning. And that creates a year-long cycle of development, implementation, reflection on how it went, redevelopment, reteaching, and you get through the whole cycle in the year, and then you talk about it at the end of the year, and you redo it, start the whole cycle over again the next year. So that's how we get. That's how we build local partnerships. That's how we get support from the local community. That's how it becomes project-based and interdisciplinary, and that's how we get structured reflection by students, because we're constantly working with the teachers to keep them thinking about their process. So I'm going to real quickly talk you through one curriculum that these two teachers developed in first grade. It's a year-long study about how food gets from the farm to the table. starts off with picking apples in the apple tree in the schoolyard and making cider. That's how we get kids thinking about it initially. We call it a spark experience. Then they might build, they go to visit an apple orchard, and they might come to the class, back to the classroom and build what they saw with blocks. Then they might go out and see a great local greenhouse. Again, a greenhouse that's somewhere nearby. We have some really nice support from folks. Kids see what's growing, they learn about growers, they learn about people who grow food, why they grow it in greenhouses, why we grow food in the city. And then they might build that back in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Then they'd write about it. You know, and so this might happen in different stations. They might go to the greenhouse and there's a block station over here where they build it. They write about it over here and they build it with styrofoam and plastic over here in the other corner. But what we really try to get to is midway through the year, we have kids publish a book, a giant book about farms. And they look at bees, dairy, cows, manure. That's always a popular topic. fruits and vegetables, grains, bees. And one of the things that we really emphasize with those teachers is that the kids do a drawing. Then they draw it again, then they draw it again, then they draw it again. Because usually when kids draw a bee the first time, this is kind of one of the in-between drawings. It's an icon, it's not a drawing. So, whoops. Oh, there we go, sorry. So that might be, I didn't have the bee drawing to show you the next stage of it. That's the finished product for the cow product. You know, that's a pretty good drawing. It's a pretty sophisticated scientific drawing for a first grader right there. That was at least 5 or 6 drafts. But, and then the other thing is when we present this at family presentation in the middle of the year, they show their drafts along with the final product. Mm-hmm. So then later in the year, they look at agencies that help people get access to healthy food. This is one called City Fresh. They make healthy lunches, healthy school lunches. They go on a tour, and then they make a set of greeting cards about City Fresh that's given to City Fresh. So it has a service learning component that then City Fresh can use to give out to market its products.
Do you involve families in this program?
So do we involve families? So families go on a lot of field experiences. We have a school garden, and there are certain family members that are skilled gardeners that come in and work with us. The kids, every grade level is required to do a family presentation. So families all come into that, and kids present their work, they present their drafts. They get, there's usually some element of feedback from the families in that sense. But in terms of I'm trying to think if there's an example of a whole family where they would be involved in the direct teaching and learning with the kids. I can't think of that. It would be something for us to consider in a more strong way. So you're at the end of the year, very end of the year, we grow a salad garden. They harvest a salad, and that's another aspect of reflection. They think about, what did it take to grow this salad, and what do we learn throughout the year as we're eating our salad? We use a lot of community partners, including gardeners. It's yummy. So then there's the final piece that I'm going to talk to you about today is student practice. I'm trying to get it done in 15 minutes. I got 3.5 minutes. Practice, experiential and hands-on. It's driven by the students. There's independent and group work element to it. There's service learning, and I'm going to throw in a new one, teen employment. That is a money stream that you all can access. There is money, federal money and state money and city money to employ underserved, underprivileged youth in the summertime in environmental jobs, and I'll talk about the impacts I've seen on some kids in a minute. So we do, in second grade, we study Boston neighborhoods. We work with this gentleman, Jose Maso. He is a grandparent. He's also happens to have a radio program on WBUR. We take kids on neighborhood investigations. We focus on Boston's this funny city where it's all called Boston, but there's all these neighborhoods that everyone knows, but there's no boundaries, there's no government, they're just neighborhoods. And they have names, like Mattapan and Jamaica Plain. So they all study them, and they study the different characteristics of them. With Jose, often as their leader, he's recording their observations as they go. We often look at murals around the city. That's an important aspect in a lot of different parts of the city. We experience it internally. So this is Chinatown right here. Then they write, each kid individually writes an aspect of the radio program. They write the radio program as groups. Like there might be one whole chapter on Jamaica Plain. But then individually, they each have their peaks that they have to rehearse. And the verbal literacy is incredible. When a kid has to sit at a microphone with him as a producer in the other room and have to go through their piece and read it and say the word and, not and duh. And then to say that, and he makes them say it, it's a really powerful experience for them in terms of literacy. So here's the final piece. Here's the teen input. That's the service learning piece. They make, I forgot to tell you, they make this program for WBUR, then he airs it on his, Consalsa is really a music program. It plays Latino music. But he airs all their, one show, he plays Latino music, and he plays a segment from the kids, and then more music, and then a segment. So then, here's the teen employment piece. This is, we just ran a retreat at the end of the summer here for kids that were employed in summer jobs in environmental organizations all around the state. So this kid worked for, I think, a program called Groundwork Somerville, where they go in and do backyard remediation. Like if there's lead in the backyard, they'll do remediation so people can grow vegetables in their own backyard. We had them make life maps. So I'm going to tell you three stories. But what was fascinating about each of their life maps was that there was some element of transition in their life, usually from another country for these kids. There was often an element of despair, well, not for not this particular kid in the transition. And the environmental experience is how they got over that despair and that transition. And they often talked about how they didn't realize, they just took the environmental job because they thought it was something cool to do and they needed money. But they, all of them, you know, came out of that experience with strong sense of connection to the environment and wanting to do more. So this is Manny. He talked about his home and how he lived in the projects, and he his major transition was when they finally got out of the projects and they moved to Medford. And it's kind of hard to discern this from this, but what got him inspired to do the environmental work was all the trash from Dunkin' Donuts he was noticing outside his door when he'd walk outside the projects. And forgetting her name. Oh, it's on there.
We're all mind reading.
So she told the story about how she was hanging with the wrong crowd. She was, you know, in eighth grade, key moment in her life, because saw herself going the wrong way. She got the idea that maybe if she had a job, she could transition herself away from this crowd. She went to a local career agency called Career Point, not necessarily an environmental organization. They showed her like five or six jobs. She worked for ended up working for the Trustees of Reservations, and how that experience of the Trustees of Reservations connected her to positive role models that were her peers, and also positive role models that were adults, and also inspired her to think about how she wanted, you know, to work toward environmental improvement in the future, all in one summer. But in a lot of the stuff we've talked about the length and depth and breadth of experiences. Well, when you're getting paid all summer to do an environmental job, that is the length and depth and breadth that we're talking about that's not possible in an academic setting. So then the final piece that I'll wrap it up here is, there's these two, I handed you out one of these, and then there's this other one that Rachel handed out. And just in thinking about your work and how you're going to advise this process, so a marketing consultant once told me that you guys, meaning all of you in this field, have images that most companies would kill for in terms of, like, you know, what our product is. But we don't do a good job getting the word out. So these two products are just one attempt to start to get the word out about our work more, to think about how you're going to do that in your work going forward through this process. I think it's really important. So thank you. I went 2 minutes over. Sorry.
Do we have questions for Bo or Rachel?
Of the age of your
students? The main school I work at is K through 8, but these kids in the teen employment were all 15, 16, 17.
So did you mostly work in one school,
this
K-8? What
was it that
you presented on?
And
if
so, how do you scale up
what
you're doing?
So we had a conversation about
can you take that mic?
Oh, I'm sorry.
What was there?
So the question was, did I work in one school that was K-8, and if so, how to scale up? So when I was with this project, COSI, we were in a total of 15 different schools, and from rural New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, to urban Boston. So that's hardly scaled up. More recently, I've been working with just one school, K-8, on an intensive level, and then do some other work with a local nature center that works with five more schools in Boston. So, you know, the scale-up question is not easy, but I think that what is also maybe important to keep in mind is that I don't think everything has to be whole school. This school happens to be whole school. They've brought this type of teaching to a center of their focus. But I do think that to work with any one teacher or set of teachers, that level of contact with the teachers and support and professional development needs to be thought of as a multi-year process. So I do a lot of that whole process I just described, working with the teachers, is, you know, really critical toward the success. Like that farms and markets unit, that's, and I didn't even share all the different elements of it, that's, you know, 5-6 years in development. The first year we went to a farm, we made some posters and we brought them down to the local food co-op. Mm-hmm. So it's grown from that. Another hand up back here.
How much of your time is spent being sort of the broker with the community, all the different communities that you work with, as opposed to that responsibility being on the teacher's shoulders and time?
A lot. The relationship builder between the community members and the teachers is a really critical role, mm-hmm. because oftentimes they don't speak the same language. They don't understand each other's needs and constraints and opportunities. Okay. What I try to do, especially as I work with teachers in a more veteran situation, is I try to teach them how to do it, and I do less and less of it with those teachers that I've been through the cycle with a few times. Teachers that are brand new, especially if they're brand new to teaching and brand new to the school at the same time, I try to do all of it because I don't want a bad experience to happen and for them to get discouraged and move away. But teachers that have been through this in a lot of cycles, they can do it on their own.
Paige?
Do you feel like teachers need any specific training to implement the place-based education model? Because we have to, like, sort of teacher training stuff, and a lot of it we're feeling like is implied in what you all are talking about, but...
No, so the question was, do we need to do any specific teacher training work to get this going? And I think what I think about this is it's a little bit hard for me to separate myself out because I've been with this one school for so long, is it's important to have some sort of introductory benchmark experience that is more than just a couple hours, and preferably maybe several sessions over several days or a weekend or something like that. But what's even more important than that is some level of going back to them and continue to work with them. So in all initial planning, there's action plans developed, the teachers do it, but then there's in one element, you're just going back in and checking in with them, make sure that that helps keep them moving forward. But on another level, they're running into roadblocks and you're helping them get through those roadblocks and figure out how to get on to the next step. And that's just, so that's the part that I call applied professional development. You know, it could be called just a meeting with teachers, but it's not. You know, even though you're just planning the nuts and bolts of how a field trip's going to happen, you know, for a lot of folks, it's really, especially if they're in the lead, it's hard for them to think about how can I maximize the educational effort in this one field experience. You know, what do I need to do with my kids beforehand? What do they need to do when they get out there? And what are they going to do to follow up on it?
Jamie?
I guess it's on that note, but are there other organizations working in Boston, and I think anybody can answer this question, where you think they've developed a relationship with a school because that's who they've always worked with,
right?
Whatever their program might be, whether it's a teacher professional development program, or maybe they just take kids and do activities with them at their center, that either has gotten to a level of engagement that you think it takes to see this whole school, you know, effort take place, or that is on the cusp of it but perhaps isn't really thinking about going there, but they have the relationships with the code. I mean, is that a model that could be looked at for scaling up?
Absolutely. Can I take a couple minutes to answer your question? It's kind of got, unfortunately, a little bit of a lengthy answer for that. One other piece of consulting work I do is this thing called the Boston Youth Environmental Network. A funder asked us to develop a network of EE organizations in Boston. And one of the ways we network, one of the ways we do our work, is we develop this small grants program that's really easy for teachers to apply for. So the idea is that they apply for this grant and there's only two questions. is to help teachers go out, like say with the aquarium or with Thompson Island or whatever, and do a field-based learning experience. And so Thompson Island has to become certified. They go through a training, and then the teacher and Thompson Island have to answer two questions. How does this support my science curriculum? How will this field learning experience support my science curriculum? And what is your evidence that the two of you have planned this experience together? They can answer those easily. The applications come in on a Thursday. They find out on the following Monday, and they get to go. But what we've noticed through that process is that certain schools and certain teachers, so one teacher will do it in fifth grade, and then she'll tell the fourth grade teacher, then Thompson Island's working with the fourth grade, or the aquarium is actually the example I want to talk about. So the aquarium is then working with the fourth grade, and then the third grade, and then they applied for a grant to do a more sustained and intensive partnership with that school, to essentially become the aquarium school. This particular school happens to be right on Boston Harbor, so it's a nice setting. And they're developing this, you know, sustained intensive relationship that's gone beyond just that initial. So what that small grant program did was it sort of tilled the soil, and they found their school where they can have a relationship where there's fertile ground to do the work, and then they took it from there. So the piece for a funder or for somebody else is to think about scaling up is how can you till the soil, and then how can you provide the support for somebody to ramp it up when they find a place to do it.
So how do you get the word out about this resource through science coordinators in the school? What's your avenue?
The grant resource? There's a district-wide science coordinator. She's on our committee. She actually has the final say over whether it connects to the science curriculum or not, but we've all gotten pretty good at it. That's actually the other kickback on this is all these EE organizations sitting at a table together reading these applications saying, do they really support the science curriculum? And I think they've learned a lot in the process, too. So she's one of our words out, but then also the organizations, the individual nonprofits themselves get the words out, and teachers are pretty good at word of mouth stuff, too. Yeah, getting the word out is not a problem.
Okay, great. Thank you, Bo. And now, Julian, take us home. Julian, it's a tough task of being the very last speaker.
Yeah, I realize I'm keeping you all from a drink across the street. Trying to go pretty quick, but do feel free to interrupt me. I'm going to be presenting some work that I did as part of my master's thesis at University of Michigan under Professor Zint, who you heard from earlier. And it's about the strengths and limitations of school sustainability rating systems. So just to give sort of a sense of what I mean by school sustainability rating systems, Kevin described them earlier as green school programs. Basically, it's any sort of voluntary program that awards some kind of recognition to schools for meeting some sort of criteria, some requirements. So I put the logos of a bunch of them up there. Hopefully some of these are familiar, and we're blessed to have a few folks involved with a few of these in the room. And so I do want to say right off the bat that although what I'm about to present is somewhat critical of these programs, I also want to really acknowledge the good work that they've done, and I mean my criticism in the most constructive way possible. So I don't want to sort of take these organizations down. They're doing great work with limited resources. But I think there may be opportunities to do it even better. So that's what I hope to focus on. Okay, so you may be wondering, why do these programs even matter? Why don't we just get legislation in place and that'll solve our problems or create new standards? And the reason that these programs matter, and I should mention, sorry for the annoying acronym, SSRS stands for School Sustainability Rating Systems.
We know all about annoying acronyms.
I know, you're very comfortable with them.
As long as you don't pronounce it. Sir.
I'd like to buy a vowel.
Anyways, these programs matter because they're already guiding sustainability efforts at many schools, especially things that go beyond compliance with standards, right, things like that. These are what schools are using to decide what they should do for their sustainability programs. They also have the potential to help schools understand and better communicate what they're doing around sustainability or the environment, help them set goals and measure progress towards those goals. They also could help schools learn from one another better by gathering information in a central place. They could, if they were structured well, they could create incentives for continuous improvement so that schools they get recognized as they continue to get better in terms of sustainability. And then finally, and more generally, they help raise the profile of sustainability since getting recognition now. So maybe it gets administrators to pay a little bit more attention than they might otherwise. Oops. Okay, so when I started this project to understand this landscape, I looked at the academic literature to see what was already out there as to whether these programs are effective and why or why not. And there's really not very much research, unfortunately. I found three empirical studies that evaluated the effectiveness of these programs, and they all actually focus on eco-schools, which is an international program. We have National Wildlife Federation does the U.S. version of it, but it's in over 100 other countries. And none of these studies, I should mention, are in the U.S. The first one is studying eighth graders in Slovenia and found slightly higher environmental knowledge, but no difference in environmental awareness or behavior when they looked at a group of students in an eco-school and then a control group of students in a non-eco-school. The second study there, same thing basically, but with fifth graders in Cyprus, and this time found slight improvements in behavior, but no change in environmental cognition. And then the last study is primary students in Ireland, and found higher levels of environmental behavior and opinion leadership, but minimal differences in environmental knowledge. So it's kind of a mixed review. There doesn't seem to be any really big impact, but there is some positive indication, although the outcome that appears to be positive effective is different in all these cases. So there's not much to go on here, but it does suggest that we might not be meeting our potential, that maybe we may be able to do a better job. And so because there's not a lot of research on school sustainability rating systems, I started looking at rating systems in other sectors, and there's still not a great deal of research, but there's much more research when you start looking at sustainability rating systems for businesses or products. And out of that literature, I was able to pull out a group of seven best practices for rating systems. And these are speculative. They're my attempt to summarize the research that's already existed. There is quite a bit on the practitioner side on rating systems, where different organizations have created rating systems to evaluate rating systems. So that's where a lot of these come from, but some of them are a little bit more speculative, and they're really just things that I think seem like should be important based on some evidence, but not necessarily empirical evidence. So it's an important caveat. And I am going to go through, because our focus here is best practice, I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these and why they might be important and what they mean. So strong accountability mechanisms, what I'm talking about there is really, is there any mechanism in place to ensure that the data that a school submits to get a rating or to get recognition is accurate? It's not that I think schools are intentionally cheating, but oftentimes the requirements are a little bit fuzzy and you can sort of interpret your data charitably, let's say. And it may be totally unintentional as well. So what some programs have, they'll have the rating system administrator will go and check the data, or they'll even have a third party check the data. But that's the highest sort of standard, to have a totally independent body verify that the data is correct. And the reason that's important is really just to build trust in the data, because otherwise you really don't know is it accurate. And it gives stakeholders a greater level of security that they can believe the rating. The next best practice is the use of performance-based criteria. And that would be in contrast to more strategy-focused criteria. So a good sort of example of a performance-focused criteria would be energy consumption per square foot. It's quantitative. You can see it varies over time, and it's not simply yes or no. A strategy-based criteria would be, does the school use compact fluorescent light bulbs or LED light bulbs or something like that, where it's a yes or no question. And the reason performance-focused criteria tend to be better is, one, you actually know that you're getting what you want, if you're measuring the outcome that you're looking for. Because otherwise, you could just be doing a whole lot of activities but not really changing the actual outcome that you want to change. So you could be installing lots of light bulbs, maybe you're not installing them right, or people aren't using them correctly, so it's not having the impact that you want it to have. The other benefit of performance-focused criteria is they tend to allow innovation better, because they're not prescribing a particular strategy. They're just saying how much energy are you using on a per square foot basis. So a little more flexible in that sense. Moving on to the next best practice is comprehensive tropical scope. And the point here is that we want rating systems to look at sustainability or environmental issues in a broad way to make sure that a school that earns a sustainability credential is actually doing all of what we think sustainability means, not just looking at one or two dimensions of sustainability. And it's also important to avoid trade-offs between different dimensions. So for example, if you're just looking at say, waste, you might think, oh, we should switch to more prepared foods so that we don't have to do the preparation in this cafeteria, and therefore that'll reduce waste. That's probably true, but it might have negative side effects in terms of student health or even the environmental impact of the food that comes more prepackaged. So that's why we try to promote more comprehensive scope. The next best practice is open governance processes, and the idea here is really just that the green school community has some influence over the process, and that they're able to control the direction of the system to make sure that it really meets the needs of our community rather than just sort of the whims of the administrator of the program. But there's a process through which it changes over time. Then multiple levels of achievement. The basic idea here is that you want the rating system to be accessible to a broad range of schools, not just schools that are, I guess I should contrast multiple levels of achievement with a binary system where it's just yes or no, you either get the award or you don't. With multiple levels, it's more like there's a bronze level, a silver level, a gold level, or a platinum level. And that tends to be attractive to a much broader range of schools because you can have the low level of entry for schools that are just getting started, and then help them move up to a higher level of performance. Public reporting of submissions. Basically, it just means does the program make available the data on which its rating is based? Is that data publicly available so that schools can learn from one another? And then finally, does the program make its criteria and methodology transparent so that if you're deciding whether you want to participate, can you actually see what the rating means? So I'm going to get to the results and see how the green school community or the school sustainability rating system landscape did on these criteria. First, I'll just share, keep going the wrong directions, I apologize, the sample that I used. So I looked far and wide on the internet, and then I consulted a number of environmental education email listservs to try to come up with a comprehensive list of all of these programs. And I identified 32 English language programs. About two-thirds of them are administered by nonprofits, and the others are managed by government agencies. They're mostly based in the U.S. with a few in Canada and then one in Australia. About a quarter of them are focused on just a specific schools in a specific city or county. 44% are focused at the state or provincial level. Then there's one that does a few different states, not necessarily contiguous, just a few states across the country. 25 are national in focus, and then one could apply to any. They didn't specify any geographic scope at all. They could be used anywhere in theory. So, in terms of accountability mechanisms, most programs don't have anything more than first-party verification, which just means they trust the data that the school submits. And about two-thirds of programs have no verification at all. Quarter do second-party verification, which is pretty good. And then only one does third-party verification in all cases, and that's the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED program. They require third-party verification always. And a couple of the hybrids, they require third-party verification in some cases, but not others. So overall, it's not too encouraging, and it does suggest that there may be reason to be skeptical of some of these ratings, to be skeptical that they're based on solid data. In terms of the criteria focus, almost all programs just included strategy only. They didn't have any performance requirements at all, or they didn't even look at them as assessment criteria. The 20% that did, a few of those, they really just had one or two performance criteria. It wasn't many at all. So this, I think, is an area for a lot of improvement, that we could be incorporating more quantitative performance metrics in our assessments and our determinations of whether a school is really green or sustainable. On topical comprehensiveness, I tried to divide up the different topics that a green school or school sustainability rating system might cover. So you can see those along the bottom. You can see that waste and energy are included in almost all of the rating systems. But on the other hand, food, greenhouse gas emissions, buildings are all pretty low. And I'm not too worried about greenhouse gas emissions because that's covered largely in energy and transportation, but food is pretty surprising. It's covered in less than a third of the rating system that I looked at. And given the environmental importance of decisions around food and also the health implications, I think that's sort of surprising for me. And I should mention, too, none of the programs were fully comprehensive. None of them captured all of these topics. There were some that got pretty close, but none of them had a criteria related to every one of these topics. So it does mean that you might be able to get a sustainability credential without really doing all of these different aspects of sustainability. In terms of governance, this is an area where I think we did the worst. Only three of the programs had an open governance process where there was clear indication of how stakeholders could get involved and that stakeholders had a meaningful role in determining the evolution of the system. And those three programs, it's one of the lead program, and then two of the Collaborative for High Performance Schools, or CHIPS, you may have heard of. So they're both the green building related programs, were the only ones that had very clear public governance processes. The rest of these programs did not. So again, there's a danger that these programs aren't being guided by the green school community, and therefore may not be serving the green school community's interests as well as they could be. On levels of achievement, it's a bit more encouraging picture. 75, or just over, just under two-thirds, or sorry, just under three-quarters of the programs had more than one level of recognition, so that's pretty good. And you can see a lot of them had even more than four levels of recognition. The only sort of caveat to this is that in most cases, the highest level of recognition was still pretty easy to get, and it wasn't actually very difficult. And so it means that the schools may get this top level recognition, and the outsider might assume that that means they're actually doing really well. That's not actually the case because the requirement isn't very hard. And in many cases, getting the top level of recognition is mostly a matter of persistence. If you just stay in the program for a few years, you can probably get to the highest level. So that's an area to work on. Public reporting, again, not very encouraging. Just under two-thirds of the programs don't provide any information beyond maybe a list of the participants, but they don't provide information about why a school rated the way that it did. The ones that do, they just do a partial public reporting. And in most cases, that takes the form of some summary paragraph describing what a subset of the schools do. It's not sort of a comprehensive accounting of all the different things a school is doing. So the opportunity for schools to learn from each other is really limited because of the lack of public reporting. And then finally, the good news is that all of the systems I looked at were transparent about their criteria and their methodology. And that, you know, in some ways doesn't seem that surprising, but if you contrast it to rating systems in the business world, this is an area where we're actually ahead by quite a bit because we are fully transparent. Okay, so just to sum up then, the strengths of the school sustainability rating systems are that we are transparent about our criteria, and we do have multiple levels of recognition. On the other hand, there's a number of weaknesses that suggest there's substantial room for improvement. So we tend to be weak accountability mechanisms. Performance is not a major focus of the assessment criteria, and overall the criteria are fairly weak in terms of the requirements. There's limited topical scope, governance processes are fairly closed, and then finally, most programs are not reporting publicly on exactly why a school rated the way that it did. So, we're thinking about where we go with this. What's maybe a way to improve the situation? And I think consolidation of rating systems may be an important part of the solution. Because the way that I see it, and I showed you that all the logos at the beginning, there's a lot of these programs. And I think the existence of so many programs, it contributes to some of the weaknesses that I've identified. Because it takes staff capacity to manage an accountability program or to have an open governance process or to develop high quality criteria. All those things take staff time. And a lot of these programs are so small that they're managed by, you know, a single individual. Maybe it's just a quarter or half of their job. So in some ways, it's not really fair to expect them to meet these attributes that I specified. And so I think there'd be some pretty big opportunities for these programs to work together and try to rally around a single set of requirements, and then maybe each one provides local implementation support for those requirements, rather than maintaining 30-some different green school rating systems. There's a few other benefits that would come with consolidation. First is greater brand recognition. Right now, a lot of these programs aren't well known, but if there was one national program that had support from a lot of different organizations, I think it would have a better shot at getting recognition from potential users of this data. There are also possibilities for better benchmarking and information sharing because it would be a national system. Right now, the requirements for Michigan Green Schools program are totally different than the requirements for Oregon Green Schools, so there's no opportunity really to benchmark across those programs, and there would be if there was a single national system. And then finally, I think just better allocation of resources, because there's so many organizations investing money in developing these rating systems, I think that could be better spent at helping support for the technical, helping schools on the technical side, maybe less on rating system development, which itself isn't a particularly useful function, except to the extent that it helps schools. So just to wrap up, I know I'm pretty excited about the Department of Ed's Green Ribbon Schools program. I know we'll be talking about it a little bit tomorrow, but I'm hesitant to sort of put all of, you know, my faith in that program. And I guess I want to explain also why it's not in this study. The main reason it's not in this study is because it's not technically a rating system as I've defined it. I define rating system as a set criteria, and then any number of schools that meet those criteria gets the recognition. Under Green Ribbon Schools, they just give recognition to the top 50 to 100 schools, no matter how many meet some minimum level of criteria. So it's an award program rather than a rating system. And I think that limits its effectiveness because it means only a small number of schools can actually get recognition in any given year, and therefore you're not reaching sort of the whole mass of schools that you want to affect. Likewise, there are no tiers, so it's not particularly accessible to beginners. Only schools that are close to being leader schools are even going to apply for Green Ribbon because otherwise they're not going to get the recognition. And although there is a common template for the criteria, standards do still differ by state under Green Ribbon. Each state gets to set its own standards, and only some states are participating. To date, Green Ribbon doesn't have any public reporting. I think that's something that they're thinking about, so hopefully they'll correct that in future years. Governance is still fairly closed. They've been pretty good about inviting input from the Green Schools community, but ultimately the decision remains for the Department of Education. And then finally, the one other cautionary note about Green Ribbon is that it is vulnerable to politics. I was in the Department of Education, and so who knows if there was a change in administration or just budget shortage, Green Ribbon may not survive through that. So just some things to think about is in terms of thinking about best practices for rating systems. The Green Ribbon has a lot of potential in getting schools rallying around a common set of criteria, but there are also some other considerations to think about. So that's it.
All right. Any questions for Julie? Why are you apologizing?
Because I took up more time than I need to last time. I just had a clarification question, and it was specific to the comprehensiveness of the sustainability and that you were evaluating the programs on. And you had on, it was the table graph that you had with, yes, that one, thank you.
Yeah.
The end of the day. What is the administration? How is sustainability in administration? Like, how did you evaluate for that? What does that mean? I'm not sure exactly I understand.
So the question is, what does the administration category mean? It's a good question. What I'm basically trying to get there is, to what extent does the criteria address sort of support from the upper level administration? So something about the principal or the district superintendent being on board with sustainability, maybe policies as well, or some sort of whole school indication of support for sustainability. So it's a little bit more than just what's happening in the classroom or what's happening in the facilities, but it's what are the upper level decision makers think about sustainability.
Kat.
I just wondered, I can't remember the term you used, but
So you had said the criteria for reaching the higher levels was not that strong, and I wondered what you used as your criteria of evidence that this program or schools in these programs were making a difference.
Yeah, good question. So the question was, and I should go back to that slide too. So the question was, when I said that most of the requirements for the top level of performance fell short of full sustainability, what I meant by full sustainability. And to some extent, I didn't fully define out what it meant, but I just looked at the criteria and where they stopped out and to what extent that seemed to fall short of, let's say, you know, being 100% renewable energy, all sustainable food. So it's sort of the ideal campus that's really far from anywhere we are today, but sort of the vision of where we want to get to. So I didn't fully write it out, but it probably would be close to actually what Green Ribbon is promoting. Is their three pillars, where all students are environmentally literate, the school contributes to the health of students, and the campus is, or the schoolyard is zero impact. So that's sort of the idea, but something aspirational that indicates where we want to go and where the school should, you know, ideally end up.
Did you find, that's a pretty high ideal.
It is.
And even the Green Ribbon is up there, but there may be a more typical, more acceptable, yet still attainable and also meaningful level of achievement. Did you consider that in your review?
Yeah, and so I think we could have a good debate about where that top level should be. I do think it should be set as sort of high as possible to sort of provide continuing support to get to that top level, even if no school reaches the highest level for quite some time. And that's the benefit of having multiple levels, is those lower levels, schools can continue to work up to it, and then they always have something to strive for. So I would sort of, it's totally possible to set it lower and say, let's do something that's more attainable that we know schools can get to now. I think that's limiting, and then over time you have to update it and it gets more complicated. I think it's beneficial to have a really high level that's always aspirational almost. Because what you find is that some schools will really strive for it and will get pretty close.
Well, I didn't mean that you should get rid of the top level. I meant that you have a way of evaluating these programs. It's not just say, well, you know, is everybody paying, but say, well, here's either a minimum or here's an average. How many are getting it here? And then how many are
you doing? I see. Okay. And so I would have liked to do that. The criteria are so different that it's hard to sort of aggregate them and compare to one another who has stronger criteria, because they're all looking at different things with different numbers. So that wasn't possible, but that would have been interesting.
Well, Mark, and then.
Well, thanks for your presentation. I learned a lot about it. I just want to throw out an idea. Reflection and comment on the Green Ribbon being an award system rather than a rating system. So I had a PhD student do a very detailed, in-depth qualitative study of an organic farming network in Southwest Virginia. And the most striking finding was that once they would achieve the organic label, the stamp, they'd stop innovating. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there isn't a benefit to, you know, an award system as opposed to a rating system with a defined ceiling. As you know, once I'm gold and there's nowhere else to go, you know, it would take nothing but an intrinsic motivation for me to keep innovating, and I have all kinds of excuses to stop, right? Because I'm at the top.
And that's the benefit of having steps, right?
Yeah, yeah. And if the top step is high enough, right?
So the question was, is there a benefit to awards program because they encourage continual improvement, whereas an award does have to, there's something, over the rating system, there is a top level, and after you surpass the top level, perhaps there's no incentive. But I think you're right. But that's why I advocate structuring that top level to be basically everything we would want a school to do, so that it really is deserving of that top level of recognition. But you could also set it up so that it did continue to escalate potentially, that there's even a level above that that's reserved only for the top 5% of participants or something like that. There are things you could do, but I think you're right, though. That is a real limitation of the organic program, that after you get certification, you're done. You just have to keep it. And that is why I really like having more than one level of certification, so that hopefully, if it's designed right, there can be that continuing incentive to improve.
So we had... Let's see, we had coming about this table, and then we'll come to Karen and to Robin.
I just have a quick one.
So we heard some of the core qualities or recommended qualities of what place-based education is defined as being essential to these whole school instructional programs. How many of those looked familiar to you based on what you looked at and the way schools would rate curriculum or instruction or environmental literacy?
So the question was, how closely aligned are the place-based education criteria that we just heard about with the criteria that green school rating systems are using to evaluate curriculum? And I'd say the curriculum is one of the hardest parts for these programs, right? Because, and I never saw anybody do it particularly well, but they would ask questions that I guess line up reasonably well that were yes, no, like, do you have classes on environmental studies, or is environmental issues integrated into the classroom? Or maybe they'd go a little bit more deeper and they'd say, is energy in the curriculum somewhere, or water? And so that tended to be topical like that, unless, I don't think I saw many of the place-based education best practices directly represented, but some of them might say just simply, do you use place-based education? Like, they tended to be simple yes or no questions. And that's, again, I think sort of a weakness, but that was the approach that I saw most commonly employed. And sometimes they would actually give class exercises too, which was actually kind of cool. Some of these programs do really good technical support, so again, I don't want to minimize the good work that they do. And that's where they might say, to what extent are you using our resources that we already provide? And so they would get them sort of a better handle on how teachers were teaching this material.
Rachel, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, at the very beginning you put up those three studies about the rating system that were, I know those were published. I know that there's lots of evaluation work being done that's not published, in journals and maybe not even put up online. Do you know of evaluation work that's going on around these rating systems? I mean, are these programs also trying to evaluate their impact?
I know some are increasingly. I know there's some study that the Maryland Preschools Program is undertaking right now, but my knowledge is not complete yet. And I think some of these programs do informally, they survey schools and ask them how they're doing, but those don't provide, they tend not to be compared to a control group or anything. It's more just how helpful do you find our program? And that provides a moderate level of evidence that teachers are using this stuff and do find it beneficial, but it doesn't really answer the question of, after teachers use it, does it make an impact on the students?
Right. I came across one in Australia that looked at outcomes, but I can't recall. But if you did like Australia, what's the Australian one called? The green school one there? Like maybe Australia and grade schools.
Australia Sustainable Schools.
Sustainable Schools, I bet it's right. Sustainable Schools in Queensland. And then evaluation, you might come across it. That's the one I found. I don't know if any of you have come across any others. I certainly know we looked. I've looked for a long time. And I know Julian looked.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's more. Just finding them. Your work.
Working on it.
Yeah. Yes, that's Julian. Julian has done a wonderful job, and we're trying to one more round of edits and then submit it, hopefully, and we'll see if they'll take it.
Yeah, the thesis version of it is online on the University of Michigan website.
Karen, and then Robin.
I just want to thank you. I'm really excited that you focused in on those two areas of improvement of more accountability and having them be performance-based criteria. I just think that is exactly the direction when we look at these school rating systems. We need to be looking at that, because then that also answers that question of how does this link in with place-based education. If we can look at the numbers and we can have students be engaged in that investigation, and feel that sense of ownership, is exactly what we want. In fact, it's even in our Mid-Atlantic environmental literacy strategy, so it just happens to be in there. But I think that's exactly where we want to go. I'm really excited that you came and presented on that. So my question is, though it seems like you're definitely leaning towards the, instead of fixing the state systems, we should have a national system. Why not focus and make our state system stronger? Or could there be also be an opportunity for maybe a Mid-Atlantic regional system as opposed to a national one?
So the question was, why focus on a national system? Couldn't we also improve the state systems or perhaps even have a Mid-Atlantic regional rating system? And you certainly could. And if there, in absence of a national system, that might be a good thing. My argument would be, though, that there, the differences between schools on a state level probably don't justify the need for the existence of a separate rating system in each state. I know there is differences in state policy, obviously, that are important. But for a lot of the stuff, at least at the criteria level that rating systems currently are at, there didn't seem to be a strong rationale to have it at that fine-grained regionality. So just in terms of reducing the burden of maintaining all these rating systems and facilitating comparisons across the entire country, I think a national system is preferable. But if there isn't an organization that steps up to do it, then I would say a Mid-Atlantic regional one would be preferable than having every state in the Mid-Atlantic with its own.
Right, so, okay.
But I do think in all these cases, the larger aggregation is generally preferable, unless there's a really strong rationale that there's the differences between the schools are so great that it would be really hard to make a system that would enable reasonably fair comparisons between them. Not even fair is the wrong word, maybe meaningful comparisons. But I think there are things that schools in the Mid-Atlantic can learn from schools in the Pacific Northwest and vice versa. So to the extent we can get everybody using the same system, that would be a plus.
Robin, you have a question?
No, I have a few comments about a few of the topics that have been brought up here. West Virginia has what we call a sustainable schools. It is the platform that our schools would apply for to advance to what would be green schools. The reason why we chose sustainable schools is because of the situation as is in West Virginia. We didn't think anybody would be opposed to the idea of sustainable schools. Yeah, we thought everybody could buy into that. So with some of the conversations that you've had, we've used the model application that was given, that was created on the national level, and we've used that both last year and then this year to model our application because we thought it would be easier for our schools and if they just took the information from this and found a compatible part on the national level to put it on. There were several changes from last year's application to this year where you said about simply check yes or no. They've eliminated those checks. And both those times, last year and this year, if you had yes, you were supposed to provide evidence of that. In other words, what was going on. I also did notice that they had used meaningful outdoor experiences. And that was the language for students going outside and doing things of value as it would relate to sustainability or the environmental topics. I know in our state we had conversation about how high do you set the bar, is to have a school being awarded. And we didn't want it to be too terribly discouraging. So the analogy that I would liken it to is this year's state football champions may not be nearly as good as last year or the year before, the year before, but they will still be this year's champions because they will have won, not because they achieved, so many touchdowns or extra points. So that might be the best analogy.
Don?
Are you familiar with the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED rating system?
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that was one of the systems that was included.
And is that more or less a system that you think might be? It sounds similar to what ideas you have in terms of a rating system at different scales, self-applied, third-party evaluation. In that case, people paid for the privilege of applying, mm-hmm. which helps generate the money to run it. Mm-hmm. But is that more or less a system you think would be a good national model?
So the question was whether the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED program is sort of what I have in mind for a national model. And I think LEAD is doing a lot of things, or USGBC is doing a lot of things really well with the LEAD program. I do like the third-party verification. I like that it's mostly performance-based. I like that they have really clear criteria, that they have an open governance process. So it's positive in a lot of ways, but it does have some limitations, one being that it is expensive and probably overly complicated for schools just getting started, even at the lowest level of involvement. Their focus is on buildings. So that's, I think, the primary limitation is they do a great job in the built sector, built environment, but that's not the most important thing that happens in the school. It's on the educational side. So I think LEAD does offer a good model in a lot of ways, but there's a need for something beyond what LEAD provides.
Art. Sorry. I was thinking about this in the whole national system and how, like, that's great for the rating part, but a lot of many elements of the green school systems on the local level are the development of the partnerships that help get you there, right? And so what do you think about, would a national system do any favors to those partnerships or disincentives?
So the question was, would a national system provide the same level of benefit in terms of local partnerships that often come out of the current system of green school rating? And I think that's a legitimate concern. What I would hope in any sort of consolidation is that the organizations that currently administer their own rating system would now be sort of the local support arm for the national rating system. So they would still be doing all that support, but they'd be using the same criteria as is used in the neighboring state and the state after that. So we'd all be on the same page of what sustainability means and what schools should do, and all be reporting to the same place. But we wouldn't give up those local partnerships, because I agree those are essential.
I'm
wondering if there's limitations. We have one room schoolhouses and we have things that resemble small cities. I'm wondering what the limitations are in terms of one standardized rating system, given that notion.
So the question is about whether there's challenges to making a one-size-fits-all rating system given the broad diversity of schools. But I think that's an entirely legitimate concern. No rating system is going to provide a perfect comparison. It's not possible, even within a fairly narrow range of schools, just because there are so many ways they can be different by climate versus public versus private schools, all kinds of differences. But I think that you can structure a rating system so that it takes those differences into account. You have normalization factors, so you obviously wouldn't just ask about absolute energy consumption. You'd do it per student or per square foot, or some way to take into account different sizes and different populations. It would be imperfect, but I don't think it's insurmountable. And I also don't think that the current state level or county level focus really solves that problem either. Even within a county or a state, you have that level of diversity. So I don't think there's any particular difference or challenges the national system would face that are not already being faced by a state or local system.
Following up on Bart's question, and maybe someone else's, but we talked earlier about the importance of making this relevant to student lives, and that it's hard to do that on a state level, but it becomes even harder on a national level. I'm sort of torn. I keep going back with my head thinking, well, there's certain things that are surely you can generalize: green roofs, water quality, reducing waste, and all that. But then there are other things that, well, we're moving water quality to the Chesapeake Bay. I don't know. Maybe you could set up a system where it could be adaptable. Here's this national thing. We don't want people to completely adapt it, because what's the point? But here are places where you can fill in the blanks. I don't know. Do you think that's possible, or is that an issue in your mind?
So the question is whether there are enough local differences and how that would play out in the national rating system, and how things that are tailored to the Chesapeake Bay would enter into a national rating system. And I think that is a challenge, but I think most of the operational things, as you mentioned, are pretty, you can cross them anywhere. There's maybe water conservation is more important in some region, but you can design a rating system to grant more points to water conservation in those areas. So a lot of the physical campus is pretty transferable across the country. On the curriculum side, though, you're right, there are definitely regional priorities. I think, though, that you could design a rating system that doesn't prescribe to specifically what you teach, but does grant points for an integration of some sort of place-based learning. So the school would then have the choice to determine what exactly that means for its context. So I don't think that would be insurmountable, but certainly it would be a consideration.
Well, it could also generate a lot of interest and excitement, because you could make comparisons between what's happening in Texas and what's happening in Alaska, and what they are doing different, what they are doing similar, and what that means.
Julia, do you know how STARS handles that issue, the one for higher ed?
Yeah, so Michelle is asking about a program called STARS, the Sustainability Tracking Assessment and Rating System, and that's how I actually got into this. I helped create this rating system for higher education institutions in my previous job, and it's now in use by several hundred campuses across the U.S. and Canada, and then we do have a whole section on curriculum, and we did leave it pretty flexible. Basically, you get points for the percentage of your courses that include sustainability. We have a definition for what a sustainability-focused course is and what a sustainability-related course is. But then each school gets to tailor that a little bit, or each college, to its own circumstances, and may define to some extent what that means for them. And so that's the way it's worked. It's not perfect, and we have gotten some variability in how schools interpret it, and so we're working on how do we provide a stronger definition so that there's still that flexibility, but there's a little bit more consistency in how schools are interpreting it. So it's an evolving thing. You're never going to get it perfect, but I do think there are ways to get it pretty close to that.
I'm not going to cut off Don Baugh, so. Question, go ahead.
Have you thought about, rather than creating a new rating system, instead looking at existing rating systems like Uber-ridden schools and trying to provide a green component to that so it becomes part of the mainstream as opposed to part of green?
So the question is about whether we could integrate sustainability or green criteria into existing rating systems like Blue Ribbon schools. I think that would be awesome. But besides Blue Ribbon schools, I don't know what else is out there that people are using. And Blue Ribbon, again, I mean, Green Ribbon was created to be the green version of Blue Ribbon. So there's probably, I don't know if that receptive in incorporating sustainability into Blue Ribbon, but I think it'd be great.
Well, thank you very much, Julian. That was... you know, certainly Bay Program isn't advocating for, you know, we need a national program or anything like that. But we do want to, one of the things that we've talked about as far as tracking and metrics is, low-hanging fruit, green ribbon schools, green schools. Who's got them? Check, check, check. But if we're really talking about, you know, ultimately benefiting the environmental quality in the Chesapeake Bay, I think we need some kind of assurance that green schools, green certifications are really getting to better environmental quality and better stewards of the environment. So it's something to think about, and I really appreciate that. So what I'm going to propose, we're going to have a... Shannon literally is going like this. We're not going to do like a work at your table and then report out or anything like that. But before you leave this room, please talk to the people at your table about that matrix that's on it, because that then is informing our conversation tomorrow. We're going to be coming back in here and we're going to get another version of this, but it's going to have, I think it's good, correct me if I'm wrong, but it has, you know, less little... parts to it, compartments. It's less compartmentalized, but we're going to come back and we're really going to start getting at what are some of these the best practices. Draft, all caps. Draft best practices. That's what we're trying to get at. So before you leave, talk at your table. It's going to be kind of tough for us.
Yeah.
But talk at your table about, okay, what are some ideas? What do we think we're going to, you know, or if you have a thought, put it down on that piece of paper so that you can bring it tomorrow, because it may leave once we leave this room. Jamie, do you have anything else?
This is management.
Well, let me give me.
Management by committee is always a fun thing, but I think it would be great to hear from folks before we break up from the day
if there's something that's burning in you that you feel like is going to be imperative to what we do tomorrow to get the most out of it, then you can tell us in the open setting or just find us before you leave. Because I think the one thing we missed by all of us, I think, is somewhat, blurting out whatever it is that struck us from today, is that information is really what will help us shape tomorrow. So find us before you take off or wherever you need to go if there's something you really want to tell us about what you want to have tomorrow.
And then the last thing I'll say is if a couple people who are leaving, Mark's leaving, Rachel's leaving, a couple other people are leaving, maybe Tina. So thank you very much for being here today. Really appreciate it. And then for the webinar, so we'll start it back up at 9 a.m. tomorrow, and we're going to
hopefully
have it up and working. So for those of you on the webinar, thank you for enduring it, and I'm sticking with it. I really appreciate that. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Gavin.
Yeah, I figured they wouldn't be able to hear it anyway.
Do we have anybody join us?
There was about 5 or 6 people on there. Sarah was listening in, and it wasn't very good quality. So I'm going to take this stuff home with me and try to work
it.
Yeah. So I don't know. Everything's connected. When Ben and I were doing it, I could hear Ben perfectly. And
it was great right after lunch. Like, right after recess, it was perfect. I could hear everything and still there. So I took it off for a while, and then by the second or third speaker, there was so much feedback that I couldn't even hear the presenter anymore.
And see, the only thing
was trying to rearrange it.
The only thing that I ever mess with is one thing that I was messing with is this button and this button, and that's all. And then once you said it was bad, I was like, so I'm gonna do my best tonight to try to figure it out.
Yeah.
No, it is. You have other things to do, right?
Yeah, that's a crazy.
I'm going to bring my agency company to see what they think about going to the route for having these people come in.
Yeah, you should have like a training session. Submit it to the grant. Ask for that.
Right? Exactly. Yeah.
Well, really, don't.
Deep breaths. You're fine. I sent your speaker.
Thank you.
Now, what can I, once we finish up, I'm going to go to whatever I need to do.
Thank you. That's right. Yeah, do you know what you're